The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized and made to seem either to be communist or some sort of disloyal person. They've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. The only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only way. Fight the power.
This week in radical history for the week starting January 12th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for January 12th. New World Shenanigans in 1641 in Jamestown, Virginia, passes a law that if any Indian commits a crime, the first Indian apprehended must pay the penalty, even if it's with his life. Also for January 12th, anarchist Anglo-American sculptor Sir Jacob Epstein lives on this date in 1880, most known for his creation of the sculpture in the tomb of Oscar Wilde in Paris. More American indigenous news on this date in Florida in 1833, they passed an act making it unlawful for any Indian to remain within the boundaries of the state. Also on January 12, 1928, police seize 800 copies of the lesbian novel The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe Hall. Both the UK and then the United States governments treat this first well-known English book on lesbian life and struggles as pornography. In the land of the free at that time, the Great Seal of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice depicts a book-burning event. Also on this date in 1933 in Spain, the anarchist uprising, which began on the 8th of January, is brutally suppressed. The greatest success of the movement happened in Andalusia. Police and army buildings were attacked, and anarcho trade unionists seize public buildings and proclaim libertarian communism there. As government forces sweep the area, in a small village of Casas Vajas, the government demonstrate their cruelty by assassinating many in the villages, burning alive all gathered in a thatched cottage. Also on January 12, 1940 in Canada, during this month, Emma Goldman's mail is intercepted by government censors, their suspicion raised by many of the letters containing money pouring into her address for the defense of anarchist Arthur Bortolotti, whose case attracts further attention in the U.S. through articles in The Nation and The New Republic. As Goldman raised bail money for him, he is now charged with immigration violation rather than breach of War Measures Act. By mid-January, Goldman returns to raising funds for the Spanish anarchists.
How many roads must a man walk down before he calls him a man?
On a date in 1963, Bob Dylan sings Blowin' in the Wind on BBC radio presentation of the Madhouse on Cattle Street. The song became a classic with 1960s protest movement.
How many times must the cannibals fly before they forever fail?
On January 12, 1968, USA and Cambodia announced an agreement designed to insulate Cambodia from the war at Vietnam. Not to fear, Tricky Dick Nixon and Henry Hank will, with a rain of bombs and secret illegal invasions, set the stage for massive Cambodia destabilization and more killing fields. Also on a state in 1971 in England, the home of Robert Carr, MP, is bombed after he introduces an industrial relations bill in a drive to crush trade unionism. This and many other bombings is attributed to the Angry Brigade.
The United States Congress voted on this day in 1991 to authorize the use of military force in Kuwait to repel the Iraqi invasion there. Kuwait had been stealing oil from under Iraqi soil by drilling diagonally using specialized slant drilling equipment manufactured by a U.S. company, and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's appeals to the United States to pressure Kuwait to desist went unheeded. Hussein threatened to invade Kuwait and received a neutral response from the United States. By the time Iraqi troops crossed the border, Kuwait had been largely evacuated, and Iraq captured the country with minimal bloodshed. A carefully concocted public relations campaign launched by the PR firm Hill and Knowlton employed the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to deliver testimony before Congress that she had witnessed Iraqi soldiers removing babies from incubators in a Kuwaiti hospital. Although that testimony was later revealed to have been a complete fabrication, it had an effect on Congress, which voted to send U.S. troops to Kuwait. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, January 12th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Enid Quinn.
Thanks to the Neighborhood Network of Columbus for all the great audio I use for this show. This week in Radical History for January 13th. In 1099 in Syria, the God-loving crusaders set fire to Mara and slaughtered 3,000 Muslim captives, all for Jesus.
Did you ever notice how in the Bible, whenever God needed to punish someone or make an example, or whenever God needed a killing, he sent an angel? Did you ever wonder what a creature like that must be like? A whole existence spent praising your God, but always with one wing dipped in blood.
More God news on January 13th. In 1777, Jefferson gets Virginia to make sodomy punishable by castration.
Dipped in blood, dipped in blood, dipped in blood, praising your God, dipped in blood.
Also on this date in 1874, the first Thompson Square police riot and massacre occurs. As unemployed workers demonstrate in New York City's Thompson Square Park, mounted police officers charge into the crowd, indiscriminately clubbing adults and children, leaving hundreds of casualties. The New York police commissioner boasts, "It was the most glorious sight I've ever seen. Those with jobs face wage cuts, while the jobless go hungry." In the winter of 1873, 900 people starved to death, and 3,000 deserted their infants on doorsteps in New York alone. Only a couple more items for January 13th, 1909. Anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman lectures on the dissolution of our institutions in San Francisco. Buwalda, a military man, was court-martialed for attending one of Emma Goldman's meetings. The evidence presented at his trial was that he was seen shaking hands with her. Also in 1929, Wyatt Earp, a noted scoundrel, crook, and U.S. Marshal, dies at age 80. Lastly, on this date in 1979, the YMCA files a lawsuit against the Village People over the song YMCA. The suit would later be dropped. This week in Radical History for January 14th. 1892, Martin Niemöller, pacifist pastor, is born in Germany. He famously coined these words: "In Germany, they came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I'm not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak up. And when will they come for you?" In 1963, George Wallace is sworn in as governor of Alabama. In his address to the state, he says, "Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever." Also on the state in 1970, anarchist pacifist Amon Anansi dies, best known for his work in operating the Joe Hill Hospitality House for transients in Salt Lake City, Utah. Influenced Dorothy Day and Utah Phillips, Hennessy was a self-described Christian anarchist pacifist who never paid taxes and refused to be drafted into any war. Also on January 14, 1981, President Jimmy Carter authorizes sending combat equipment to El Salvadorian junta, just another democratic gesture of free-loving people. Also on this date in 1996, 16 protesters arrested at the winter blockade at a rural Wisconsin site for the U.S. Navy's ELF transmitter, which transmitting targeted signals to nuclear weapons aboard U.S. submarines. A total of nearly 400 arrests have occurred in 24 actions in the last 5 years at the ELF Navy site. Lastly, for January 14, 2005, Army Specialist Charles Garner Jr., ringleader of the band of rogue guards at Abu Ghraib prison, convicted at Fort Hood, Texas, for abusing Iraqi detainees. Scapegoated to protect higher-ups in the Bush administration torture policies, he'd later be sentenced to 10 years in prison. Bush officials in jail for torture? That would be zero. This week in Radical History for January 15th, more Christian beliefs. In 1757, the Archbishopric of Cologne approves a schedule of fees victims of torture must pay, up to 5 talents for being quartered by horses, for example.
Praising your God dipped in blood.
Also on January 15th, 1809 in France, Paris-Joseph Proudhon is born. Famous philosopher, economist, socialist, often referred to as the father of modern anarchism. Of anarchy, he once said, "Property is theft, anarchy is order. Whoever puts his hand on me to govern me is a usurper and a tyrant. I declare him my enemy." Also on this date in 1877, Standing Bear, a Ponchatt chief, refuses to move the reservation because it is within the lands already given to Lakota. When they learned they were going to be moved to the Indian Territories in 1876, they sent 10 chiefs to the United States agent to look over the land and its prospects. They were to make the decision for the tribe. Based on what they learned, the chiefs could not make a favorable report. The tribe voted not to go to Indian Territory. The government then forced the tribe into Indian Territory without their consent. The tribe arrived in Oklahoma Territory too late to plant crops, and they were not prepared for winter, causing many deaths, including the death of Standing Bear's son. More land of the free. Also on this date in 1929, American civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr. lived in Atlanta, Georgia. Also in 1968, the Jeanette Rankin Brigade. Led by 87-year-old Rankin, the first U.S. Congresswoman and only member of Congress to vote against U.S. entry into both world wars, marches on Washington to protest war in Vietnam. At the opening of this year's Congress, the coalition of women's peace groups called the Jeanette Rankin Brigade demonstrate against the Vietnam War. The New York Radical Women stage a burial of traditional womanhood, and this was the first use of the phrase, "Sisterhood is powerful." More colonial news. In 1981, El Salvador, the American support of Salvadorian government disappears 8 staff members of the El Independent. Lastly, in a state in 1991, President Bush restores $42.5 million in military aid to El Salvador. 15 children under 14 who had been detained, charged with terrorism, were found decapitated. 13,500 civilians murdered or disappeared in 8 months, and the Army no longer bothers to use prisons. This week in radical history for January 16, 1893 in Hawaii. The Hawaiian Queen's regime is overthrown by U.S. pineapple tycoon Sanford and Doyle and pro-annexation sugar interests. With an amazing sense of timing, U.S. troops just happened to land to protect American interests. With support from U.S. Minister John Stevens, Dole declares himself Hawaiian president and lobbies for U.S. annexation. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee recommends annexation, declaring it, quote, "a duty that has its origin in the noblest sentiments that inspire the love of the father for his children." And the rest is history. Also on this date in 1916, Emma Goldman gives a lecture at the Masonic Temple in New York City on the child's right not to be born. According to New York Times, Emma said that, "if everyone followed the injunction of the Bible and Theodore Roosevelt to be fruitful and multiply, every tenement house would be turned into a lunatic asylum." More news you never read in textbooks. In 1920 in Russia, the Allied powers recognize the independence of Russia, Georgia. The blockade of USSR is raised. Few Americans know that the U.S. was part of the invading and occupying forces of Russia during this period. Just more of what they don't bother to teach you in schools. Lastly, for January 16, 1984, Paul and Linda McCarthy is arrested in Barbados for possession of marijuana. Since Clinton came into office, the number of marijuana arrests has not only nearly doubled, but is also greater than the entire population of Chicago. The federal snitch program offers rewards for the guilty and punishes the less guilty, with minor offenders given sentences ranging from 5 years to life without parole when dealers snitch on one another to avoid going to jail to reduce their sentences. The snitch program allows any person to be convicted without physical evidence, solely on the testimony of one individual, i.e. the drug dealer, without corroboration. Since the U.S. drug war has been proclaimed, the percentage of major dealers sentenced to prison remains under 10% of all drug-related convictions. This week in radical history, for January 17th, I only have 3 items. 1863 in Colorado, Apache chief agrees to peace talks, is then arrested and imprisoned at Fort McLean, Arizona, then shot by 2 soldiers in his cell. Also on January 17th in 1915, anarchist Lucy Parsons leads a hunger march in Chicago. IWW songwriter Ralph Chaplin writes his famous labor song, "Solidarity Forever," for the march. Lastly on this date, 1961, President Eisenhower delivers his farewell address warning the nation of the military-industrial complex and its acquisitions of unwanted influence. What few know is that Eisenhower's original notes mentions the triad of military, industrial, and congressional complex, but he felt including Congress in a lineup would be too much to bite off. This week in radical history, for January 18, 1863, soldiers of the California Volunteers torture and shoot Magus, Colorado, Apache chief, in what has become New Mexico. Magus approached a white army camp seeking a settlement to the war between the United States and the Apaches. He was assured that the camp would enforce the truce. After his warriors leave, however, whites take Magus prisoner and shoot him. Then his soldiers take a scalp, others cut off his head and boil his flesh and dump the headless body into a ditch. The official military report claims Magus was killed while attempting to escape. After learning of Magna's death, Apache chiefs lead their warriors in a guerrilla warfare against whites in the Southwest. And that is how the West was won. Just three more items for This Week in Radical History. 1911, Japan. The cry of Musifu Shirgi Banzai, long live anarchy, resounds in the Japanese courtroom, shouted by Kanu Suga, one of 26 defendants in the high treason case. This is in response to the death of the hanging verdict of 24 of them. The other anarchists received prison terms of 8 to 11 years. In 1962, Vietnam, U.S. began spraying foliage to reveal Viet Cong guerrillas. Chemicals like Agent Orange would not only cause widespread birth defects in Vietnam, but also U.S. soldiers handling such materials. Lastly, in 2002, U.S. flies 6 terror suspects from Bosnia to custody in Cuba after Bosnian Supreme Court orders them released for lack of evidence. That is Justice Texas style.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends. And some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were 3 of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced at the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios. This program can be found each and every Monday at the RadioForAll.net website. A reminder that you can find other great anarcho programming there as well, such as the following.
This is Noam Chomsky speaking on Anarchy Now, putting the rad into radio.
So this program, Anarchy Now, and other amazing works all can be found at the RadioForAll.net website. Inspiration for This Week in Radical History came from the Slingshot Organizer. Get your new 2009 calendar organizer at your local radical establishments. A lot of the rad info for the show came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Thanks to all these lovely resources, and thanks for taking some time out of your day to listen to this little ditty. I'll be back next week, so until then, a reminder that I'm always and forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon. This week's show is dedicated to all my brothers and sisters struggling and dying.
Chère France entière, un vieil homme dans un grenier, pour la nuit nous a caché, les Allemands l'ont pris. Il est mort sans surprise.
Graves, the wind is blowing, freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from the shadow.
Billions of people just living out their lives, oblivious.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي فوز قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative the Palestinian voice from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning our entire broadcast features Middle East scholar and analyst Mui Rabbani. Rabbani, of Palestinian heritage, was born in the Netherlands and educated at Tufts University. Rabbani is currently a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, a co-author of Jadilia, and a contributing editor to the Middle East Report. This Week in Palestine recorded Mui Rabbani at an informal discussion at his alma mater, Tufts University. He speaks about the current situation in both Syria and Palestine, and then takes questions. Here is Mui Rabbani at Tufts University.
I've been asked to speak about Syria and Palestine in the context of the regional upheaval in the Middle East. And to begin, perhaps, with a few general comments in terms of the upheaval that the region is undergoing. I think there's several broad themes that we see either being intensified or reversed, ironically enough, now in Syria. And those are trends that I would identify as fragmentation, disintegration, state collapse, and the growing prominence of non-state actors filling in those gaps. So perhaps I'll start with Syria because it helps kind of contradict everything that I've just said. What we've been seeing in Syria, I think, is a gradual reversal of those trends, particularly since late September with the beginning of the Russian military intervention in Syria. I think Syria's great misfortune this past half decade is that the conflict in Syria has been more or less about everything but Syria and the Syrian people and the rights and future of the Syrian people. It has rather become an arena for every conceivable regional agenda and proxy conflict. And when I say proxy conflict, I don't mean just the usual ones, such as the United States versus Russia or Iran versus Saudi Arabia, but it's become the arena even for proxy conflicts between, for example, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, between Turkey and Egypt. So to the extent that even people or actors who are nominally on the same side of the equation are often more preoccupied with their own petty, if you will, internal rivalries than they are with their struggle and conflict against their, let's call them their more formal adversaries and enemies. This had resulted in a kind of prolonged stalemate in Syria for a period of several years until last summer, with perhaps the death of the former Saudi king Abdullah, for whom reducing the power and influence, regional power and influence of the Muslim Brotherhood was a key policy objective, being replaced by the current king, Salman, for whom, in the context of the Iranian nuclear agreement, mobilizing what was perceived by him, I believe, as a united Sunni front, if you will, against Tehran, took precedence. This led to a reconciliation of sorts between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar. The formation of Jaish al-Fat, the Army of Conquest, comprising several of the key Syrian rebel groups in northern Syria. And what we saw in the late summer or the late spring and summer of last year, was this sudden, in some ways dramatic, advance by the Syrian rebels in northwest Syria, and primarily in Idlib province, which they managed to control almost fully, and beginning to threaten the coastal regions of Latakia, and then also advancing somewhat in the eastern Damascus countryside. The key moment, I think, was when President Bashar al-Assad, an autocrat who is not given to displaying weakness in any way, shape, or form, gave an address to the Syrian people, which in itself was unusual, on the 26th of July 2015, and was quite open about the manpower difficulties that the Syrian army was facing, and indicated that the Syrian army may pull back from certain areas of the country in order to maintain its control of key strategic regions. And I think it's against this backdrop that the Russian intervention in Syria should be understood and assessed. And what I would say about the Russian intervention is that, seen from the perspective of Moscow, perhaps a little less so if seen from the perspective of Damascus or Tehran, but certainly from Moscow's perspective, it's been a signal success that has managed to comprehensively transform not only the dynamics of the Syria conflict, but also the political framework within which it is being addressed. And if we look at what Russia has and has not achieved, I think it's fair to say that this quite closely reflects what they were trying to achieve and were not trying to achieve. First and foremost was to stem the further loss of territory to the Syrian rebels, and that can go down as a clear success. Secondly, to consolidate those areas that were already under the control of the Syrian regime, and where possible, to expand them. Now, those of you who have been following this may remember that when the Sukhois first took to Syrian airspace, we were treated to a lot of commentary about how, A, this is turning into a second Afghanistan. B, they're bombing everyone but the Islamic State and the Nusra Front. And C, they've only managed to take 3 or 4 square kilometers in the first month of operation. So this is obviously going nowhere. Well, what we saw in the late fall and winter of this of last year was that these constant, very intense aerial attacks on the Syrian opposition clearly were having a cumulative effect, because all of a sudden we started seeing big gains by Syrian government forces, particularly in Aleppo province, efforts to seal off the Syrian-Turkish border, which I think also became one of Putin's pet projects after the Turkish Air Force downed the Syrian jet, and basically the Russian fighter. And it was a situation in which the Syrian government was once again very much in the saddle. And that, ironically, is where the problems potentially began, because I think the Russians had a very clear understanding that there is no military solution to the Syria conflict. And their strategy is one of seeking to separate those elements of the armed Syrian opposition that are prepared for reconciliation with the Syrian government in one form or another, together with similar elements of the civilian opposition to the Syrian government, to separate those from the hardcore that will not accept any agenda that does not prioritize regime change from Damascus. And it's in this context that we began to see the Vienna process, United Nations Security Council Resolution 2254, and now this new negotiations show in Geneva. And what I think the Russians have successfully achieved is that they have taken regime change off the table. No one is anymore speaking about the departure of President Assad as an integral component of the implementation of the political process. And they have effectively, if not formally, but at least effectively, replaced the process which was supposed to lead further to the Annan plan, to the so-called transitional governing body with full executive powers, transformed it from that into what is now being described as a national unity government. In other words, rather than replacing the powers that be in Damascus, the current plan is to expand it in order to bring in those elements of the Syrian opposition that I was referring to earlier. But this is also, I think, where we're beginning to see fissures between Moscow on the one hand and Damascus on the other. And I would argue that Tehran, which is perhaps a more important partner for Syria than Russia is, probably leans towards Damascus's view. From the perspective of a family dictatorship that has ruled its country without challenge for going on four decades now, any political process is a losing proposition. Any opening is a sign of weakness that will be interpreted in Damascus as the beginning of the end. And it was in this context that we saw statements by President Assad that, in fact, what they intend to do is to reconquer every last square inch of Syrian territory and reestablish Syrian sovereignty and all the rest of it, which I think represents a clear difference of perspective between Moscow and Damascus. And this is a debate or a contradiction that I think will continue to play out in the months ahead. The issue here, of course, is that Moscow does not have very much leverage to impose its own views, because at the end of the day, they have no viable alternative to President Assad. They can, of course, reduce the level of their military support. I wouldn't really call their most recent decision a military withdrawal from Syria, but it seems to be saying to the Syrians, okay, from this point on, if you want to retake Palmyra from the Islamic State movement, we're with you. If you want to march on Raqqa and get there, and Deir ez-Zor and get there before the Americans do, we're definitely with you. But when it comes to reconquering Aleppo, you're on your own, unless you can get your Iranian and other allies to do it. And so I think we are beginning to see differences between the Russian conception of how the Syria conflict should be resolved on the one hand, and let me call it the Syrian-Iranian one on the other. Where does the United States stand in all this, just by way of my concluding comments on Syria? I think, the hallmark of the Obama administration's approach to Syria has been part and parcel of its Middle East policy, which is that come what may, no new Middle East war under Obama's watch. And although I think the Obama administration has clear preferences about what they would like to see happen in Syria, they have watched, I think, with more satisfaction than is generally accepted, that the Russians have been prepared to invest the resources and efforts to achieve Moscow's policy objectives in a way that Washington is simply not prepared to even contemplate. And if the previous American attitude towards Syria was, good luck, Moscow, and we hope it turns into another Afghanistan for you, I think they now realize the Russian approach is more in common with Chechnya than Afghanistan. And given America's own threat perception about Syria, my sense is that the Americans would not consider it catastrophic if the Russians actually succeeded in stabilizing Syria, which brings in another factor, which is that of America's regional allies, the Saudis first and foremost, but also the Turks, Qataris, and others. And here I'll just make a concluding point, since I've already made a concluding point. But I'll make one more.
Feel free.
Thank you. Which is that we often tend to look at Syria in Cold War terms. Cold War terms, which is to say you have the great powers, the superpowers, the Russians and the Americans, and then you have their proxies, the Saudis, the Iranians, the Turks. Well, things have changed a bit since 1990, which is to say that the superpowers, if I can use that term loosely, no longer have the same level of influence and control over the regional parties that was typically the case in the Cold War. If you go back to the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, you often had these third world conflicts where the regional or the local parties were not that far apart, but were for a variety of reasons prevented from reaching agreement by Washington and Moscow, who wanted to continue fighting to the last African, to the last Asian, to the last Latin American. That's no longer the case. And the mere fact of what appears to be American-Russian consensus on Syria is, to my mind, absolutely no guarantee that the regional parties are going to fall into line and fully cooperate with whatever Kerry and Lavrov decide. So the diplomatic process in Geneva is very fragile. I wouldn't put too much store in it. And I think that there are parties in the region just waiting for the first sign of collapse so that they can resume an expanded military intervention, for example, providing more and better weapons to the Syrian rebels, sending more militia forces to support regime forces, and so on. Turning to Palestine, well, there you do very much see these regional trends of fragmentation and disintegration, and you see it, of course, on multiple levels, not only within the Palestinian political system and in the context of the abiding schism between Fatah and Hamas, but also within each of these camps. Fatah has been reduced to a political movement in name only. The PLO has been reduced to three letters that no longer mean very much. Hamas has been very rapid to internalize and copy, if you will, the experience of Fatah. What took Fatah decades to achieve, Hamas has managed to achieve in a few short years, so that now, for example, the tensions between the internal and the exile leadership, between the military wing and the civilian leadership and so on, is reaching, I think, a stage of almost open warfare. I mean, to give you one example, in 2006, I was in Gaza, and I interviewed a member of a just elected member of the Palestinian Legislative Council for Hamas, and it was practically public knowledge that this individual had been strongly opposed to the decision by Hamas to participate in the 2006 elections. Yet when talking to him, he spoke with such passion that you would think that it was only because of him that Hamas decided to participate in those elections, and that he somehow single-handedly managed to convince the rest of the movement. That would never happen today. This idea of party discipline, if you will, no longer exists, and there has been fairly open warfare within the movement between, let's say, the wing represented by Mahmoud Zahar in Gaza versus that represented by Khaled Mash'al now in Doha, and and so on. And so that also, I think, has its ramifications on the reconciliation process. There are currently talks taking place in Doha between Fatah and Hamas, but basically between people who either do not have the power to make any agreements succeed, and or people who are reporting to powers that want to ensure no agreement is properly implemented. Because at the end of the day, there are the schism is getting more institutionalized by the day, with vested interests determined to see its perpetuation getting more powerful. And perhaps most importantly, a Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas, who on the one hand is still convinced that if he can only hold out for a few more months, Hamas rule in the Gaza Strip is going to collapse, and even if it doesn't, the price that he and his authority will be made to pay for embarking on reconciliation is going to be significantly higher in terms of regional and international support than the price of perpetuating the schism. And it is in this context that we've seen the growing unrest that began last fall, September, October. The problem here is that if you look at who are primarily involved in these incidents, this is not the mass demonstrations being organized by a unified national command representing the main political factions that you had in the First Intifada. These are not armed militias being spawned by Fatah and Hamas and the Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front and so on that you had in the Second Intifada. These are 13, 15, 17-year-old kids acting perhaps above all impulsively, certainly without any political direction, and I would say more significantly, without any political affiliation. And this is, I think, the real danger that the Palestinian political system is facing. Palestinians have always been a highly politicized people, in the sense that if you would look at public opinion polls in the 70s and the 80s, over 90% of people would express an affiliation at the time with Fatah or the Popular Front or the Communist Party or whatever. You look now, our biggest movement has become none of the above, and it continues to grow. And this represents a crisis of the Palestinian national movement that has, I think, no easy answers, because in my view, the precondition for addressing and resolving this crisis is Palestinian reconciliation that would see the integration of Hamas and Islamic Jihad into the Palestine Liberation Organization on the basis of national strategic consensus on a political program. Unfortunately, the prospects for that happening are simply receding, leading to a situation where I think it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that the Palestinian people are being transformed, perhaps have been transformed, from a coherent political force into a demographic reality without much political consequence. Yes, you have a Palestinian community in Gaza and the West Bank, within Israel, and Lebanon, and Syria, and Jordan. But politically, what does this mean? Unfortunately, increasingly little. And it's in this context that you have a leadership that not only has no leverage over either Israel or the United States or even within the region, but it's not seeking leverage, which almost perceives leverage as somehow a form of bad manners. And you have the most recent statement by the American administration that they will not be conducting any new diplomatic initiatives for the rest of the term. Those of you who, like me, continue to be aghast that the Oslo Accords were ever signed may think that is a good thing, but it's nevertheless a gift to the Israelis. It's exactly where Netanyahu wants the Americans to be, so that he can have his way unencumbered. with the occupied territory. So the short-term future, at least, I would say, is extremely bleak, because while we may continue to see more unrest in the occupied territories, it is not connected, not only not connected to any political project, but increasingly disconnected even from any of the existing political forces. If I can conclude on a note of optimism, the only thing I would say is if we look at the antecedents, those of you who remember the genesis of the First Intifada in 1987, it came in the context of a decade in which, in the early 1980s, the PLO was expelled from its last frontline bastion, if you will, in Beirut, at a time when the Arab states were increasingly diverted towards the Iran-Iraq war. And it came within weeks of the 1987 Arab League summit in Amman, where for the first time, I believe, in the Arab League's history, Palestine was not even on the agenda or in the final communique. And by the end of that year, the youth of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip had managed to seize headlines in places where they had never managed to impose themselves before. Of course, the problem is that came on the basis of intensive organizing by the main Palestinian factions. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but it is something I think that people are increasingly aware of. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. And now we definitely have time for questions and answers. For questions.
Please.
So is the organizing going on in villages like Bilin and Nabi Saleh and so on just a dead end in your view, or could that somehow be an example that will be taken up?
I would say it's neither a dead end nor an example. It's not a dead end in the sense that you have had these absolutely dedicated and committed people just going out week after week after week for years now, same time, same place, demonstrating against the same wall and the same occupation with no let up, and letting nothing stop them, but are doing so in isolation, because if you recall when these groups first started demonstrating against the wall, the factions would participate, Israeli peace groups would join them. That, to the best of my understanding, is either no longer the case or increasingly rarely the case. And I would even argue that the Palestinian leadership, at least in Ramallah, sees them, maybe threat is too strong a word, but doesn't want these people to form a template. Because when they do, then you get things like the teacher strike that you've had in the West Bank in the past few weeks. So it's not something that has been embraced and adopted and co-opted and expanded by the leadership. Leadership is quite happy for these people to demonstrate because it can make good propaganda use of them, but it prefers that they stay in their little village and near the Green Line.
Hi, thank you for the analysis. My name is Wissam from Palestine, and I'm a visiting scholar at MIT. I'm just wondering whether you see any opportunity for the Palestinian reconciliation in the near future based on your experience on the local context?
Probably not. When it comes to Palestinian reconciliation, I tend to defer to Hani and Masri, who I strongly encourage you to follow his columns, which are usually published every week in an AM, if you have access. And he just, I mean, his latest article, which I was just reading yesterday, was pointing out why increasingly reconciliation is also no longer an option for Hamas. I mean, we've known all along that you have a Fatah leadership, or rather a Palestinian Authority leadership, that is simply not interested in reconciliation. to the extent that with the Beach Camp Accord of 2014, Hamas basically capitulated to Fatah. It gave Fatah, or it gave Abu Mazen everything he wanted, and he refused to accept their surrender. That's why the agreement was never, because of this idea that, you know, if they just do in their own juice, of financial crisis and so on for a few more weeks, a few more months, maybe a year, it will collapse. Well, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. On the positive side, there is a growing feeling within Fatah, let's say at the second level down, that Fatah cannot save itself except in some kind of partnership with Hamas. But these are people who I don't see having the power and influence to force reconciliation down Abbas's throat. My view is that's something that remains within the power of the Palestinians to influence. I mean, if you take the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip in 2012, pillar of cloud or pillar of white phosphorus, I still remember. You know, this was at a time that there had, Mubarak had just been overthrown. You had a government in Cairo that was sympathetic, not so much to the Palestinians, but specifically to Hamas. And it was still in this environment where, you know, let's say the Arab Spring phase of the upheaval. Arab leaders and foreign ministers were beating a path to be the first in the Gaza Strip, even while Israeli bombs were still raining down on Gaza. They all wanted to get there before Erdogan, you know. So, and people who had been very hostile to Hamas specifically, all of a sudden want to have their pictures taken with Ismail Haniyeh. And so that demonstrates to me that Palestinians do have it within their power to put themselves certainly on the regional agenda, but to do that they need to get their act together. And so in response to your question, I would say that for me, reconciliation remains a first, second, and third priority, because without a national movement, without a national agenda, it's going to be very difficult to think of achieving any of these other things that you mentioned.
Thank you very much for your talk. My name is Ali Yassir. My question is on Syria. You mentioned the lack of influence of the powers on different parties participating in the conflict, and you mentioned Jaish al-Fatah. So I was wondering what role would groups like Ahrar al-Sham, Salafist groups like Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam play in any transition, or now are they playing any role in the political process? And as a second question, what is the current state of, is there any discussion in Palestine and Israel on what's going on in Syria?
Well, in response to your first question, I think this is again one of those areas where you can see a developing gap between Moscow and Damascus. They had this whole discussion over listing terrorist organizations, and I believe it was the Americans and certainly the Saudis and other regional powers wanted to have it limited exclusively to Islamic State and Nusra Front, and others wanted to have it expanded to basically even people who are guilty of thought crimes against the Assad regime. My understanding is that Moscow, for example, has not insisted on having Ahrar al-Sham placed on the terrorist list, because what they're doing now with the cessation of hostilities is basically giving these people a pause for thought. Here's your opportunity. Do you now want to become part of the regime, to put it very crudely, or do you want to continue fighting on and be treated as indistinguishable from Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra? Whereas for Damascus, you know, the agenda remains military victory and unconditional surrender of the opposition and so on. So, but the issue here is that while many of these parties seem at least prepared to entertain the prospect of serious negotiations, even if on a very different basis than Damascus is. I think there is also countervailing pressure coming on them from the regional sponsors to walk away at the first sign of failure and resume the armed struggle, if you will. In terms of how Palestinians are looking at it, it's been a very interesting dynamic. As you know, Hamas had its headquarters in Damascus until 2012, and Fatah has been at loggerheads with Damascus since the mid-1960s. What's happened now is that Hamas has withdrawn from Damascus on the basis of, regardless of the political or moral judgments one might make, it's been a severe miscalculation in the sense that I think after Morsi's election, Hamas leadership came to the conclusion that the Muslim Brotherhood was going to reign supreme in the Middle East for the next several hundred years, and took the premature step of breaking with Damascus, moving to Doha, hoping that it would at least lead to reconciliation with the Saudis and hopefully some kind of renewed relations with either the EU or key European states as well. None of that happened. The only thing they have to show for their troubles is an increasingly difficult and bitter relationship with Iran, which has been shifting its patronage to other Palestinian movements. Well, now you talk to Fatah activists, or many of them at least, the way they talk about the Syrian government, you would have think, in fact, they've been allies since the mid-1960s, and let bygones be bygones. So there's been quite a bit of a change in those perspectives. But to me, the real tragic aspect of the attitude of Palestinian leaderships to Syria has been their attitude towards the Palestinian community in Syria, which is facing unprecedented difficulties not being citizens of Syria. They don't have the option for refuge in neighboring states that Syrians do. And the way the Palestinian leaders talk about them, it's almost, you know, like spectators at a football match. There are very few signs that indicate these are their own people, let alone that they're responsible.
Yeah, I have a question about the Palestinian political movements and the streets, or the kind of chaos or loss that they are in now. I'm thinking about the factors that led to that. So when I look at between 2000 and 2003 or 2004, really Israel managed to clean the Palestinian streets from active leaderships through assassinations, send them to the exile, or sentence them life sentence in the prison. And at that time, they left the street to the Palestinian Authority, which they have done nothing to help, especially the new generation. I wonder if these are some of the factors, or if you can say more about the factors that led to where the Palestinian
Those are factors, but I would look primarily to the Oslo Agreement as the main factor. Two main aspects that were implicit in Oslo, I would say maybe even explicit. First of all is the institutional fragmentation of the Palestinian people between those in the occupied territories on the one hand and those everywhere else on the other. We're not talking about the United States or Germany here. We're talking about a people, more than half of whom do not reside in the territories of the authority. And as you know, the PLO had been an exile movement until 93, with most of its leadership and structures and so on in exile. Overnight, those were deleted. And so you basically marginalized the core, what had been one core of your constituency. Second of all, Oslo, implicit in Oslo, was a demobilization of Palestinian political activism. Now, of course, that was never fully implemented because Arafat's attitude towards Oslo was very transactional. You know, if it works, I'm with it. If it doesn't, I have alternatives. And this became clear in 2002 when he, at the very least, allowed for, if not encouraged, the remobilization of the Palestinians. But after his demise and the succession of Abu Mazen, demobilization was the one consistent policy that he's had. So I would look more towards these longer term structural factors rather than the Israeli actions, because what the Israelis have been doing, they've been doing for decades. Mm-hmm. Why is it succeeding now? It doesn't seem like they've gotten more effective all of a sudden.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
So that's just a follow-up. Does that mean that generational change is not a factor?
I think the significance of generational change is exaggerated. I don't think it's as important a factor as... I mean, this whole... there's, you know, this whole theory of old guard, young guard, and that what you have is a series, an anachronistic generation that returned from Tunis and had tired of the struggle and was no longer prepared to participate, versus a up-and-coming new and activist generation based in the occupied territories. I think that points to a dichotomy that doesn't really exist in reality. And if you look at the Second Intifada, many of the key leaders were actually returnees from the older generation, from exile. And if you look at the current situation, many of those who have been most involved in and committed to, for example, security coordination with Israel and the intensification of the demobilization are actually from the younger generation based in the occupied territory. So I don't think it's a very applicable paradigm.
I kind of have a follow-up. Looks like there's a bunch of...
Yeah, a lot of questions.
Yeah. Well, I will, maybe because it is kind of a follow-up.
Okay.
I will jump in, which is to ask about... You did end on the high note, and I and I wonder in some senses, you know, given this conversation, what does that high note mean, right? Because if the village-based and other very local kinds of organizing are, you know, really kind of being derailed in at least a passive way by the PA, right, because they could lead to popular mobilization, like in the teacher strike, then, you know... Where is the high note really leaving us with, right? Given the fragmentation, given the lack of reconciliation that you're also arguing is key for real political change, I mean, do we need to think about new kinds of mobilization that would have to happen on completely different terms? And then I'll just throw in a question of, you know, where do you think this might actually happen? Do you think 48 Palestinians have an increasing, you know, prominent role to play, or because of the lack of broader political institutions among Palestinians, is that not an option?
I think it's a very difficult question to answer because, on the one hand, the premise of your question is that because the situation is so focused within the occupied territories, shouldn't that mean that new ideas, new initiatives, and so on come from outside that very tightly controlled box? And on the face of it, there is every reason to agree with that presumption. But you can also look at it from a different perspective, which is saying precisely because Palestinian political life has been reduced not even to the occupied territories, but specifically to the West Bank, excluding East Jerusalem, that is the only place from which meaningful change can emerge, because if it happens in Nazareth or in Khan Yunis or in Beirut, it's going to be extremely difficult to translate any such initiatives into change in a system that is not only based in Ramallah but very insulated from any external from any external pressures. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of two minds mm-hmm. about it. Hedge my bets.
Yeah, sounds good.
We keep hearing about the imminent collapse of the Palestinian Authority, or at least the possibility. And in fact, the imminent collapse has been hearing it for some time. What's your take on that, and what does that mean for the? What does that look like? And immediately, what does that mean for the Palestinian people in terms of money coming in and the fact that the Palestinian Authority is the major player in the Palestinian economy, and it just, what does that mean?
I don't know, because I've never really taken those predictions seriously. If you look at the sheer volume of interests that are vested in the indefinite perpetuation of the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian interests, Israeli interests, regional interests, quote-unquote donor interests, I find it extremely difficult to think of circumstances in which this entity will be permitted to collapse or disintegrate. I mean, at the height of the Second Intifada, you had the Bush administration in Washington, you still had Yasser Arafat in charge of the Palestinians being denounced as a legitimate morning, afternoon, and night. You had the security forces indisputably involved in the armed intifada and all the rest of it. There was never any talk of, and even when the Israelis started withholding all the tax receipts and so on, you know, it was Brussels to the rescue. So I find it very difficult to conceive of circumstances in which the Palestinian Authority collapses. I suppose there is always a possibility of unintended consequences. For example, the Palestinians restrict or terminate security coordination, and Israel takes retaliatory measures, and Brussels is too late to come to the rescue. I guess it could happen. What I would be more concerned about is a post-Abbas scenario where Israel is able to use its influence to further fragment even the West Bank administration, so that you get kind of a warlord in Nablus, a warlord in Ramallah, a warlord in Hebron, and so on, and be able to further fragment the system.
Could you just expand on what you meant by warlord, and what would that be? You're seeing that as a possible downside scenario.
Well, what I mean is that you would get, you know, kind of a strongman in control of the local administration and security forces, perhaps being assisted by kind of, you know, informal militias to enforce his writ, not answerable to any kind of central authority.
You're not going to say his or her? I'm just kidding.
In this case, I'm not.
I know, I'm totally joking. Yeah, I know. Totally joking, yeah.
Although, no. and so basically you, while there may remain a nominal Palestinian Authority, and while you may, as you do now, have a Palestinian Legislative Council that never meets or legislates, you know, you would kind of, political power in the northern West Bank, in the central West Bank, in the southern West Bank is increasingly formulated and exercised there, kind of along the model of what you already have in Gaza. Mm-hmm.
So you go to Mukhtar concept of the Present Intifada?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except it would be more formal. I mean, yeah, it's the formalization of the village leagues. Mm-hmm. Urban leagues.
Well, unless there's one more question, I think this is a great time to thank Moin Rabbani for discussing all this with us.
You have been listening to Middle East scholar Moin Rabbani speaking at Tufts University.
Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land, every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As Obama departs and Trump prepares to take over in Washington, both Turkey and the Philippines remove themselves from the US sphere of influence. Are Washington's chickens finally coming home to roost, or is this just due to infighting amongst US elites? Also, another author has brought out a book on the infamous Operation Gladio, where NATO spent decades using fascist cells to blow up European towns and cities in an attempt to drive us into the arms of the Pentagon for protection. His name is US journalist Paul Williams. And our new emperor, Donald Trump, takes over on Friday the 20th of January. He'll be saying goodbye to CIA Director John Brennan, who was interviewed this week by the BBC's Gordon Carrera. Plus, as what looks like it might be a last-minute move by Obama and the Pentagon, 3,600 US tanks are being shipped into Holland and Germany. What's that all about? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, a look at the history of fair rents in the context of the present housing shortage. Also, more about Colombia and our final piece from the English Civil War Museum in Newark. Dialect noon next Tuesday. But first, I'm joined on the line by Andrew Ashdown, Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who's recently returned from Syria. Hi, Reverend Ashdown, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Hello.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you first got interested in international affairs? You're obviously not your average local kind of parish vicar.
Well, no. Well, I was brought up in Africa for a start, and since 1982, I've been travelling widely in the Middle East and Africa as well. But over the last 25 years, I've been a regular visitor to the Middle East, particularly Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt. I first went to Syria in 2003 and visited several times prior to the conflict, taking several groups into Syria as well to meet with faith communities there, and have visited the country six times since April 2014, three times, in fact, in 2016, having just returned a few weeks ago. I've been very much interested in the whole region as a place of faith communities and encounter and history and you know, the whole importance of the region on so many levels.
Give us an idea of paint a picture, if you can, for what Syria was like when you were there back in the early noughties.
Yes, one of the reasons I fell in love with the country was because it was diverse, it was pluralistic, it was actually remarkably peaceful. From a religious and a social point of view, it was actually regarded as one of the beacons of the Middle East. I mean, it was one of the most relaxed in terms of faith communities, in terms of social attitudes and outlooks, and you would see this tremendous diversity. It is one of the most diverse countries in the region of faith and ethnic communities as well. And of course, I put this very, very strongly. It was the social and religious aspects that were particularly striking. Of course, there are political issues, which were on a different level as well. But visiting Syria, you would see it as a country of great beauty, of friendly people, of acceptance and tolerance between different communities. On the most part, and one that was trying to engage with the people and the outside world as well.
Well, I mean, some have said, haven't they, that the President Assad had a kind of feared secret police which was keeping everyone cowering.
Well, yeah, you didn't actually see that. That wasn't the atmosphere you had. Now, I've been in situations in other countries where you had a genuine sense of fear. I think I've got many, many friends in Syria from all different communities, and have met hundreds of people of different communities. And their message was, if you kept your head down politically, life was fine. And so it wasn't a question of cowering. People would not try not to get involved in politics, but actually on all other levels, life was good. It was one of the sort of freest, in inverted commas, I stress inverted commas, countries in the whole of the region, where people had a freedom of faith and social attitudes. It was in the political dimension that there wasn't that total freedom. But it wasn't a question of people cowering. And one certainly didn't get that impression when talking to people. People were certainly cautious talking politically. But at the same time, I've been talking with hundreds of people even since 2014, and people are very, very open and candid about their different views and openly critical at times of the government and aspects of the government and so forth. So, no, if you visited Syria, you wouldn't get that sense of cowering and fear, which actually there might be in other places as well.
Okay, what about the difference between the way the Christian faith plays out and the way it is expressed in Syria compared to here in Britain?
Christianity and Islam, I mean, at the heart of Syrian life, I mean, it's really important to recognize that for most Syrians, of whatever faith or whatever community, faith is an essential part of their life, of an essential part of living one's life itself. In Syria, you still see, even now, in the government-controlled areas, you still see mosques and churches side by side. People, I was there just for Christmas, and actually Muslims and Christians together were celebrating Christmas on the streets and Christmas decorations everywhere, and people going to church or the mosques as they will, as I say, side by side. And that faith has been lived out for centuries, generations. I mean, Christianity was there way before it came to Europe. I mean, it came with St. Paul. I mean, the Melkite Patriarch of Syria says Christ was born in Palestine, but Christianity was born in Syria, and that's absolutely true, actually. So it's very much a part of the makeup of society, and Christians are an important part of that society and generally have been accepted as such alongside other members of the community.
Okay, so what did you see before Christmas? I mean, certainly every night on the news here, we were getting these awful tales of civilians being attacked by the Syrian Arab army in Aleppo.
Yes, well, I was in Aleppo before Christmas, and it was a deeply profound experience. I was in there actually as the city was liberated, as the vast majority of people saw it. From the last pockets of rebel, so-called rebel resistance. Most of whom are terrorist groups, extremist terrorist groups. I visited East Aleppo. I visited areas. I visited the refugee centres for the people coming out of East Aleppo. And in fact, the stories that the people were telling were a complete contradiction of what we were being told in the Western media. We spent a few hours at reception centres where people had come from East Aleppo just days before, and they were coming and they were telling how the rebels had been committing murders, killing anybody who opposed them or showed any signs of supporting the government, firing on men, women, and children who were trying to flee, withholding food or trying to sell food at exorbitant prices they couldn't afford, withholding medical aid, torture, imprisonment, all these things and rape. These stories were coming consistently from the people, and they were so happy to be out of it. And when the city was declared to be free, not only was the vast majority of the city, of course, is West Aleppo, which was being bombarded constantly by the terrorists themselves, which we didn't read about, and is the majority of the population of the city, they were celebrating in the streets when the last pockets were cleared. But so actually were the vast majority of citizens coming out of those areas who were delighted to be freed from the terrorists. Occupation. So the narratives we've been getting have been extremely one-sided, and actually in some cases downright misleading to mildly.
Well, look, Andrew, I found it very easy to get hold of you and get you on this programme. Have you been on things like Channel 4 News? Because as someone who's British and obviously quite reliable and has just been in the middle of the war zone, I would have hoped that anyway the mainstream media would have embraced you and listened to your tale.
No, I did. I contacted Channel 4 from Aleppo because there were no British journalists there. There was not one international media agency visiting the reception centres, talking to the tens of thousands of refugees coming out of East Aleppo and listening to their stories, which were contradicting the mainstream media. I contacted Channel 4. I got no reply. I contacted the BBC. The BBC local television gave me 2 minutes and cut me off as soon as I mentioned the stories of the refugees coming, which were contradicting mainstream media. And I was on a local radio station. They gave me a few minutes and tried to steer me away from the message that I was actually trying to convey. And what I'm conveying is not my opinion or my view. It's actually the voices of the people on the ground. And this is one of the most important things that we have to hear is I believe that over the past months and indeed years, we have not been listening to the people of Syria themselves, the people inside Syria. We've been listening almost exclusively to the views of highly, highly unreliable sources, exclusively in the terrorist groups. And now that many of those areas have been freed, have cleared, and civilians have been able to come back and be freed from that, they're telling what actually went on. It's quite different to what we've been informed. That doesn't mean to say that there wasn't bombing. I saw the bombing of the last area of East Aleppo, and it was quite horrific to behold. But I was glad to hear that actually most of the civilians had left that area the day before, so that particularly intense bombing that I witnessed was mostly the terrorist groups that were left. But what we mustn't forget is that for the last 4 years in Aleppo, West Aleppo has been constantly bombarded by missiles and hellfire cannon, which have been launching death and destruction on schools and hospitals and individuals as well. But we don't hear about that. We haven't been hearing about that.
How does your faith inform your interpretation of events over there?
My faith is about listening. First of all, I think as a people of faith, we've got to listen to people and love, okay? It's at the heart of it is loving and listening to people of all communities, particularly those who are suffering. Now, my knowledge of Syria over quite a number of years now, over many visits and meeting all the communities, is that the realities on the ground haven't been reported. And what I wanted to do was go and stand in solidarity with the suffering communities of all communities and to listen to the voices of the people. But it's also important that we take a prophetic voice as well. And when people in positions of power are using their own political agendas and causing horrendous suffering in the process, the Christian communities have a responsibility to stand up and say, stop, is this right? It's important to stand up and be counseled, if you like. But as a Christian, to stand alongside those multiple Christian communities in Syria, and also the other people of faith, the other Muslim communities of faith who've been standing, living alongside the Christian communities for millennia, let alone centuries.
Well, the people of Syria and yourself, what do you think's the real reason behind? I mean, there's obviously been some sort of attempt at regime change, something along the lines maybe of what's happened in countries like Libya to happen in Syria. What do you and the people of Syria think is really behind that attempt?
I think most Syrians, I mean, it's much more international agenda. Frankly, I don't think our governments care much about human rights or human conditions. I don't think that's the agenda behind it at all. I think it's much bigger agendas. It's about the wider political axes and wider political influences and agendas and interests. There are religious elements within it as well. But it's a much bigger political picture. We're very good at wanting regime change when it suits our economic or political interests, whereas other countries, and at the same time, we're seen as hugely hypocritical. I mean, they look at, you know, Syrians look at our alliance with Saudi Arabia, for example, which has a far, far worse human rights record than Syria ever had, and is bombing Yemen to smithereens with our weapons, and we're seen as absolutely hypocritical. our absolute one-sidedness with Israel over the Palestinians and so forth.
It's okay. It's a bit frustrating, isn't it? I mean, you know, do you think it has it very much affect this? Because, I mean, we'll be discussing a story after we finish talking to you, Andrew, about the way that Turkey is turning away from NATO and the United States and more towards the Russians. Also, the same exact thing is happening in the Philippines, where the people in the Philippines have decided, actually, that they've had enough, really, of dealing with the United States over many years, many decades of U.S. control of the Philippines. Do you think eventually that hypocrisy you've been describing there filters down to change people's, you know, once I suppose the British and the Americans and the West generally loses the battle for hearts and minds?
Well, I've seen this. I've been travelling for the Middle East, as I said, for 30 years, and I've seen a change in attitudes towards the people in the West. And this has been largely because of the actions and the policies of the West in the region itself, causing chaos, mayhem, destruction, and utter chaos in the region in so many levels, and never learning, and then arming brutal groups and siding with, you know, I mean, it's just been appalling what the positions we've taken. So yes, I think there is a change. I think you're right. I think people in the region, there's a shift in alliances, whether we like it or not. And obviously in the West, we don't like it. But actually, the West has played an appalling role in helping to destroy so many countries, actually, and just does not seem to learn.
Now, does faith actually manage to survive in these war zones? Because I would imagine that many people are looking at a war situation, particularly in the towns and the cities of places like Syria, and thinking, you know, dear God, surely you can't allow this to go on. And actually, it may be a falling away of faith.
Actually, quite the opposite. I think this is it is so profoundly inspiring and moving to witness and to see. You know that for example, in the churches, yes, okay, it's estimated that about only a quarter of the Christian population are still there from those that were there before the conflict, and yet the dedication of those people to their faith, both the Christians and the Muslims, is quite inspiring to behold. The local communities are doing enormous amounts of work to serve the internally displaced. Remember that there are 6.9 million internally displaced people inside Syria. That's more than all the refugees outside Syria combined. And they're being looked after by the Syrian government, by the Syrian Red Crescent, by the Syrian people, by the communities themselves. And the people of faith are holding to that faith. And as I said, I came back from Aleppo and I spent a couple of days in Damascus after I'd been in Aleppo, which was a shocking experience, seeing the devastation there. And yet even in Aleppo, I saw people saying, you know, we stand by our faith and we want to go back to our homes, we want to rebuild our lives, we want to rebuild Syria, we want to maintain the plurality and diversity of our country, and we want to see this reestablished. And as I said, in Damascus, the celebrations of Christmas were going on, and people were going out to the restaurants, and there was Christmas music being played, and Christians and Muslims together celebrating that. Even in Aleppo, I saw that. And tremendous resilience in the country. And that's something that we could learn from, actually.
Now, maybe you could untangle for us some of the different rebel groups, because obviously we've heard about ISIS and we've heard about the so-called Syrian opposition, what used to be the Free Syrian Army, also al-Nusra, who are supposed to be the sort of franchisees for al-Qaeda over there, and then there's the Syrian Arab Army, which is the official government force, as well as the Russians, I suppose, flying around in the air. And I think this is one of the things that, a bit like in the Balkan crisis, many people get kind of bogged down because there seem to be so many different groups. No one knows who's fighting who.
Yeah, I think, well, there's truth in that. I mean, it's said that there's something like 1,500 different factions fighting in Syria. Many of them, of course, are not Syrian. There are numerous foreign fighters from 80, I believe, 80 different countries are represented in the fighting factions in Syria. Yes, you have the opposition forces. the Free Syrian Army, which was sort of formed in 2011, 2012. So most Syrians actually say they don't exist. I mean, they've just been swamped now. You know, you ask a Syrian, and I'm talking about whether they're Sunni or Shia or Christian or whatever, inside Syria, about moderate rebels, and they say there's no such thing, they're all the same, because they've coalesced these multiple different groups. The most important one, of course, is Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a al-Qaeda affiliation, which seems to sort of lead the way. It was certainly leading the way around Aleppo, and currently in Wadi Barada outside Damascus as well. And underneath that, you've got other groups, smaller groups like Ara al-Sham and Jaish al-Islam, which are basically al-Qaeda affiliated to terrorist groups. They're brutal. To call any of these moderate is beyond belief, frankly. They've proven to have committed massacres, beheadings, killing, in the most brutal ways. Then you've got ISIS, which is another extreme. And fighting these multiple groups, yes, you've got the Syrian Arab Army, which, remember, are the sons and the daughters and the husbands and the wives of the Syrians themselves. The Syrian Arab Army is often called Assad's forces. It's not Assad's forces. It's the government of the country, the army of the country, who are Syrians. In fact, most of the Syrian Arab Army are Sunnis. And of course, there are different forces within the Syrian Arab Army. And then you have, of course, the Russians, who are very present. You've got Hezbollah, who are from Lebanon, and they're supporting the Syrian and the Iranians. Although I haven't seen, I haven't knowingly seen any Iranians on the ground. I have seen Russians on the ground, and actually Russians are helping tremendously with the refugees and providing medical and food aid to the refugees, the internally displaced refugees in Syria. So yes, you have multiple fighting forces, which are complicated.
Now, Russia today has just announced that it will be withdrawing armed forces from Syria, starting with an aircraft carrier group. Do you think that their job there is mostly over then?
I doubt it. I mean, I think it's an aircraft carrier. I mean, the aircraft carrier only arrived a few weeks ago. The Russians are pretty well ensconced, I think, for the moment. So when they say start withdrawing, I think start is probably the word of emphasis there. But I doubt their work is finished. The war isn't over by any means. And who knows where it's going to be.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll put a link up on our show page to a website called South Front, which is regular maps of who controls what bits of Syria. But I'll tell you what we'll do now, if you can hold on with us a minute, Andrew, because we're going to have a listen now to a US point of view on Syria. And this is the BBC's Gordon Carrera speaking earlier this week to the CIA director John Brennan, and he's got a lot of advice for the Trump administration, which is going to be taking over in 2 weeks' time. And of course, John Brennan has actually been sacked by Donald Trump, so some would say he's been causing a few difficulties before he goes. But let's have a listen to for a couple of minutes now to Gordon Carrera from the BBC interviewing John Brennan on the subject, the very subject that we've been talking about just now, Syria.
But it must be quite frustrating to watch what's happening in Aleppo.
Very frustrating.
And know that there's not much, it appears, that the United States can do about it.
It's very frustrating.
And you don't think there's much more that could be done?
I think there
to intervene or in some way to support those groups?
I do believe that the Russians hold a real key to Syria's future. And unfortunately, I think they have pursued their interests, their national interests, and the interests of the Assad government to the detriment of the people of Syria. And this, unfortunately, has resulted in the destruction of a large part of the beautiful country of Syria and the death of countless Syrians, again, with Bashar Assad's direction. He is responsible for most of those deaths.
Sounds like you're quite skeptical about the idea of doing a deal with the Russians to change the situation.
We've tried to do a deal with the Russians over the last several months since the cessation of hostilities was forged earlier this year. And we have tried to restrain the opposition groups that the United States government supports. I do not see the Russians restraining the Syrians. I think the Russians and the Syrians have taken advantage of any pauses in fighting to advance their position on the battlefield. And I think that that is intentional on their part. They've been disingenuous in many of their negotiating tactics. So I do not have confidence that the Russians are going to relent until they are able to achieve as much tactical battlefield successes as possible in order to give them what they want in terms of their ultimate strategic aims.
Well, that's the outgoing CIA Director John Brennan there speaking to the BBC's Gordon Carrera earlier this week. But we're joined on the line by Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who's just returned from Syria a couple of weeks ago, just before Christmas he was there. Andrew, what did you make of what the John Brennan is saying there?
Normal line, it's a standard line. The situation on the ground, the reason I've been to Syria several times is because the situation on the ground is actually very different. First of all, yes, the destruction has been vast. What's really interesting in Aleppo, though, remember that, first of all, Aleppo is a divided city. Is the vast majority of the population live in Western government-controlled Aleppo, and the rebels have controlled the eastern part of the city, and that has been largely destroyed. But the destruction is not largely from the air, from bombs. When you go to the sites, when you go to the cities that have been destroyed, largely the areas that have been largely destroyed, you find that actually most of the destruction is street level. Most of it is street level fighting, which by the witness of the people themselves has happened between many factions, of course, and with the fighting of the Syrian army as well. So yes, there has been bombing, and you see the evidence of that, but far, far greater was on-the-ground destruction. Now, on the ground in Syria, remember the vast amount of the majority of the population of Syria in Syria still live in government-controlled areas. If you talk to those people, people won't like to hear this, but actually they'd regard the Russians as heroes. I've seen trucks, a whole line of Russian trucks taking aid to the internally displaced in Aleppo. They're cheered. They're providing medical equipment and aid. And a lot of the people of Syria see the rebels, the so-called rebels, as multiple extremist fighting factions with a brutal ideology, most Syrians of which do not support and do not want to see Syria become an Islamic state, which is a declared intention of most of our so-called moderate rebels' allies. They want to see a Syria that is plural, as democratic as possible, diverse, and not dependent on an extreme ideology which most of these groups represent.
And so you don't think then that John Brennan's right when he says that what the Russians have been doing is to the detriment of the people of Syria. That's what he's just said there. And he's saying that they support, the Pentagon, supports the opposition groups.
Well, of course, they that's clear. The Americans do, and so do the British, which is absurd. I'm not saying that the Assad government is perfect. I'm not saying that bad things haven't happened in a war. Bad things happen on all sides, and all sides are guilty of things. But what I'm saying is that actually to say that, you know, the Syrian people want to see the interests of the so-called rebels prevail is a total and absolute nonsense. The Syrian, most of the Syrian people, who the majority are still, I stress, in government-controlled areas, support the Syrian army, and actually are really appreciated the Russians, who they regard as their saviors, because in fact Russia did, in 2015, pretty well prevent the fall of Damascus to rebel forces. No, I'm afraid the so-called rebels certainly do not represent the wishes of the Syrian people.
Yeah, but you see what... Hang on, sorry to interrupt you there, Andrew, but you see what the CIA Director John Brennan is saying is that the Russians are only really doing this in their own interest. They've got strategic interests in Syria.
Of course, yes. I mean, yeah, I don't doubt that. In the same way that, do we really think that the British government and the Americans are interested in the human interests of Syria? Do you think that we aren't acting in our own strategic interests?
I suppose you're right. Well, what do you think about what's motivating these fighters, these jihadi groups? Because they seem to think that they're actually following the Quran and somehow kind of creating a caliphate.
Well, yes. I mean, the extremists certainly, they're indoctrinated to think that. That's not, I have to say, from my experience in Syria over many years, that's not the view of most Syrian Muslims within Syria. They don't hold to that view at all. And that's most Syrians, including many Sunni Syrians, are absolutely appalled by that ideology and do not hold to it at all. As I said, if you go to talk to many Sunnis in Syria, they do not support these extremist rebel groups at all. Of course, there are political interests that they've been fighting about, but the religious ideology is an obscene ideology.
Yeah, do you think maybe religion has been being used? Maybe, I mean, someone would say that it was in Northern Ireland as well, for example, but do you think you've seen that in Syria?
Absolutely. I think the religious sectarian interests have been used and abused, in order to fuel the conflict and the interests of different communities. And everybody's got interests. I think you've got to acknowledge that. You can't sort of accuse one party of having interest when everybody has interests, I think the faith issues have been stoked by certain groups in different ways.
How would you, before we say goodbye, could you just leave us with your thoughts about how we should interpret what we see on mainstream media in order to try and get to the truth? Or where is it not worth bothering with that? Should we go to get stuff from the internet, for example?
I think that you have to look around. I'm consistently appalled by the mainstream media. I've been visiting the Middle East, as I say, for 30 years, and rarely have I seen the mainstream media reflecting a genuine, accurate and fair picture across the region, to be honest. And Syrian reporting has been absolutely diabolical, and as a regular visitor to Syria prior to the conflict and during the conflict, I can say it barely reflects realities on the ground. It's been profoundly twisted and misrepresentative. But I think you need to look at different news media and also online, and I think that there's a lot going about on the social media, and yes, there's a lot of rubbish out there as well. But getting different perspectives is important. There are multiple perspectives. There are multiple narratives, and no one narrative contains the whole truth. We've been fed one sole narrative for 5 years now, a lot of it twisted and a lot from very dodgy sources. But we have to look around. I want to just finish, if I've just got 30 seconds. The three messages that have come from the Syrian people. Now, what I say, I often say, what my view is not important. I don't really care what my view is. What I care about is the people of Syria and their voices, which is why I've been to Syria, to listen to their voices. And what I share is their voices, not mine. Their message is threefold. First of all, their cry to the Western community is to stop supporting terrorism. Frankly, most of the so-called moderates we support are terrorist groups affiliated to brutal terrorist organizations. Stop supporting all terrorism. Stop supporting all arms. End the fighting. Two, listen to the people of Syria. Now, I've met with all the internal opposition leaders in Syria, and they say, why is the world listening to all these exiles who haven't been in Syria for 15 years, whatever reason, and they're the voices that represent Syria? No, they don't. The people inside Syria represent Syria. Listen to the people inside Syria. We hardly ever hear voices from inside Syria, the people on the ground, actually, what they're saying. And thirdly, talk to all parties to exclude, whether you like him or not, to exclude the president of the country, which on a major perspective, on a genuine perspective, by international law has been protecting his country from international terrorism, on another perspective. You can't exclude the president of the country, whether you like him or not. You've got to include all Syrian parties.
Well, it's worth mentioning as well, isn't it, that Assad won an election 2 years ago with something like 86% of the vote.
Yes, and actually, that's been ridiculed, of course, in the Western media, but actually there were observers to watch there, and the observers who were there said actually that was perfectly fair. And when you talk to people on the ground, actually that does reflect the kind of thing you get on the ground. People are critical in all sorts of ways, but actually its popularity remains very, very strong. And what the Syrians say is, who is the international community to say, declare who or who is not going to govern Syria? We as Syrians, it's up to the Syrians to decide who leads them, not us or the Americans or the Syrian opposition in Turkey, or the Muslim Brotherhood, who most of the Syrians in Syria don't like. It's up to the Syrians inside Syria to decide their future.
Reverend Andrew Ashdown, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much indeed, and God bless.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, Martin, bit of a contrast there between what we heard from the CIA director, John Brennan, still just about for the next 2 weeks, and Reverend Andrew Ashdown.
Yes, well, I know who I believe. And I suspect many people, if they listen to what we've just heard fairly, should know what they believe.
He's painting a really, actually, what is an entirely shocking picture there. He's saying effectively that all of the London media, the TV, the radio and the newspapers have been effectively providing cover for some of the most hideous terrorists in the world.
Well, I mean, we've been saying this on this show for years now.
It's irreverent using the word diabolical to describe it.
Well, it is diabolical, isn't it? And don't forget that Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister under Mitterrand, not under Sarkozy, he's on the record on French TV as saying that before the uprising started, he was approached by British officials who said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria." Now, in other words, Britain is in the frame for starting this war in which at least 500,000 people have died.
That was under your Labour David Miliband. He was Foreign Secretary at the time.
Yes, he was. And David Miliband, in fact, has been going on about how he's been tweeting about how people are being raped and murdered in eastern Aleppo, even though he's based in New York. Where he got that information from, we can probably guess. Probably from the same sources as the White Helmets, etc. We have been involved in wrecking that country. Our armed forces like the SAS have been training Al-Qaeda. Can we come back to this point? We've supposedly been having a war against Al-Qaeda because they supposedly carried out the 9/11 attack. We've had 15 years. We've invaded Afghanistan. We've invaded Iraq. We've invaded Libya. We've supported we've gone all over the world doing this. And now we've got the White Helmets embedded with Al-Qaeda in eastern Aleppo, acting as their PR, funded by the British government, and of course the terrorists themselves, Al-Qaeda, being trained by the SAS. Now that's the reality that people have got to face up to. Al-Qaeda is our creation, not just our creation in the 1980s, our current creation. And if we want to defeat Al-Qaeda, maybe we have to start knocking down some British Army generals.
What about the assertion that he's making there, though, about the media? Because this does seem to be one of the main things, is he's really railing against the fact that we're just getting a completely distorted picture where the media, almost all the time, the mainstream press from London, has been backing these terrorists.
Well, indeed, and don't forget, we've got to the Brigade 77, which is a part of the British Army, which spends all of its time on social media essentially spreading lies about what's going on. I sent you an article this week, which was published in The Guardian in 2011, I think, when the rebels had just appeared in Aleppo. And they interviewed, this was when Western media were still reporting from the ground. And they interviewed a local rebel commander, and he said, "Well, the problem in Aleppo is that 70% of the population don't support us." And that would be a problem, wouldn't it, for a guerrilla army? Aleppo was one of the parts of Syria where they had least support. It was a prosperous middle-class city with a mixed population, and they were quite happy as they were. And the rebels turned up and said, "No, we're going to have a war to create a caliphate here, supported by the Americans and the British."
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that Donald Trump has decided he's had enough of the CIA director, John Brennan. Reported on National Public Radio in the US, he gave another interview. The head of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan, said in an interview with NPR, "Bloodshed in Syria was partially because of their role in the war. I think we always like to say that we wish we would have been able to make a difference in a way that would have prevented the slide and the situation there," Director John Brennan said in an interview with NPR. "There's no way you can divorce yourself emotionally or mentally from these situations that you play a role in," Brennan said, adding that he felt some responsibility for the horrific bloodshed.
Well, what he means by that is we should have bombed some more. I mean, John Kerry this week said, who was Obama's, you know, Secretary of State, said that he blamed Britain for us not going to war in 2011.
Well, Brennan carries on, "This insurgency is not going to go away until there's some type of viable and genuine political process that will bring to power in Damascus a government that is representative of the Syrian people," Brennan said.
Well, it's just more blah, blah, blah. In 2011, the Syrians had an election which Assad won overwhelmingly. and in actual fact Assad is emerging as a major figure both in Syrian, Middle Eastern and world politics. He and his lovely wife Asma Assad, both of whom were brought up in Britain and speak perfect English, are regarded in many parts of the, of Syria and elsewhere as on a par with somebody like Abraham Lincoln. They've held the country together. They've squashed a racist rebellion by slave-owning jihadis. And not only, and you know what? If you're up against that sort of opposition, maybe there is no point talking to them. Maybe the Russians are wrong here to call a ceasefire. I'm sure that won't be very popular on the ground in Syria. They say, well, hang on a minute. You, but the Russians, in fact, are playing a mediating role. They're trying to say if they can find somebody to talk to that's worth talking to. But if I was an ordinary Syrian, I'd say, to hell with that, let's kill them all off and get rid of them, including their British Army and US Army backers. They've got to be made to pay a price as well. They need to be sent home in body bags, don't they?
Martin, one of the things that the mainstream press just do not report is the number of foreign fighters in there. They're really not Indeed. Syrians fighting. The US road map to Balkanized Syria is an excellent article by Pepe Escobar. Back in September, he's dug out some Defence Intelligence Agency document which was declassified in May last year from 2012. It says, it talks about the empire of chaos's real agenda in Syria. That's his words. He says, quoting from the document, he said, the West, Gulf countries and Turkey, who support the Syrian opposition, is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria. And this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime, which is considered the strategic depth of the Shia expansion in Iraq and Iran.
Well, what he's hinting at there is the role of strategic interests of Israel. Which have also also been involved
we've
in this
talked
as well,
a lot about this.
It's not just the British generals and US generals that need to go home in body bags, it's also Israeli generals as well, isn't it?
We've talked about this Balkanisation of the Middle East planned by Oded Yinon, haven't we?
Yeah, the Yinon plan came out in the 1980s, said we want to Balkanise all of our neighbours through creating civil wars in their countries.
There's one great
and that's what, exactly what they've done.
One great hypocrisy here, which is that we're talking about terrorists. The whole definition of terrorist is about a non-state actor, and yet actually it looks as if the West has been backing terrorism to a massive extent.
Well, of course they have. They've been backing them all the way. And what Syria shows me is that the pretense that Al-Qaeda, which was set up by the Western intelligence services with the cooperation of the Saudis in the 1980s to kill Russian conscripts in Afghanistan, and then they said, oh, Al-Qaeda's gone rogue, we've lost control of it, they've carried out 9/11, what can we do? I think that they've been in control of it all along. I think the Saudi intelligence services, working with the British, the Americans and the Israelis, have controlled Al-Qaeda from the get-go and they still control them today. They've got to be defeated. Al-Qaeda must be defeated. I'm not a pacifist. Let's defeat them.
Let's go north a little bit to look at Turkey, because last weekend, over New Year's, there was a horrific attack on a nightclub there. Although there seems to be immediately completely conflicting information coming out about where how many attackers there were. For one example, on BBC World News, they had one of the people who was hiding in the nightclub and managed to survive on there, saying that she saw either two or three attackers. And yet all the mainstream press is saying there's only one guy and we think we know who he is and we're now after him.
Well, in Turkey, over many years, people are very well aware that the deep state involves itself in false flag terrorism. It's a fact of life. Top US Turkish generals were sent to prison by the Erdogan regime when it first came to power some while ago because they were convicted of carrying out terrorist attacks which made to look like Islamist attacks, made to look like left-wing attacks, made to look like Islamist attacks. And it's a fact of life. That's what goes on.
Okay.
That's the real world.
Also, the US warned Turkey of potential ISIL attack over Christmas, says and the New Year, says the US government sources anyway. The message titled Security Message for US Citizens New Year's Eve Celebration also urged US citizens to be mindful of this when deciding to attend public gatherings for New Year's Eve celebrations in Turkey.
Well, one of the suspicions must be, knowing what we know, that the assassination of the Russian ambassador and the attack on this nightclub, which was half full of foreigners, these could be carried out by the same NATO intelligence services, the Israelis and the Saudis, who've been backing the terrorists on the other side of the border in Syria. And I'm pretty sure that plenty of Turkish police officers will be very well aware of that possibility.
Meanwhile, looking west a little bit, the US has sent 3,600 tanks against Russia, and a massive NATO deployment is underway. This is Operation Atlantic Resolve. It's in full swing. 2,000 American tanks are being sent in coming days from Germany to Eastern Europe, and 1,600 tanks are being deployed to storage facilities in the Netherlands. At the same time, NATO countries are sending thousands of soldiers in towards the Russian borders. According to US Army Europe, 4,000 troops and 2,000 tanks will arrive in three US transport ships to Germany next weekend. From Bremerhaven, US troops and a huge amount of military material will be going to Poland and other countries in Central and Eastern Europe.
Well, what's happening is that the CIA and others in the deep state in the US are trying to create a situation where whatever Donald Trump may think, he is going to have to continue the policy of confrontation with Russia and also, you know, the wars to obtain power in the Middle East. And, of course, Trump's a deeply contradictory figure because he talks out of one side of his mouth about building a better relationship with Russia, and on the other side of his mouth he supports the far right in Israel who've got no interest in peace whatsoever, and he wants to provoke a war with the Chinese. So very dangerous times we live in. And, of course, the deep state in the US is trying to the one positive aspect of his policy, they're trying to sabotage it. And that's what this is about.
Okay, what about Russian warships docking in the Philippines on a goodwill visit? And we've got a little bit of audio on that as well, actually, this week. Russia is offering the Philippines close relations. And you're going to hear now a report which was on CNN Philippines this week. The reporter, David Santos, speaking to and recording the Russian ambassador to the Philippines, Igor Govayetsk.
Russian Ambassador Igor Kovayev speaking to the media Wednesday on board Admiral Tributes, the Russian warship on port call in Manila this week. Moscow is ready to work with Manila in addressing threats to security and sustainable development.
We are ready to supply the Philippines with sophisticated arms and weapons. Russia has a lot to offer. But everything will be done in full compliance with the international law.
By diversification, Kovayev was referring to the need for the country to look beyond traditional partners such as the United States. The ambassador had strong words against the U.S. when asked about allegations Russia meddled in the U.S. presidential election through cyber attacks. In response, he dismissed the accusations, calling them mere rumors.
The most powerful country complains about interference from a weak Russia. So it means that the United States he looks like a banana republic, which is not able to defend your election system from interference from abroad.
Describing Russia as a reliable defense partner, Kovayev cites their relations with longtime ally Vietnam. He says Vietnam never accused Russia of interfering in domestic affairs throughout its close to seven-decade-old alliance.
We never use military cooperation as a kind of political leverage on our partners.
Kovayev repeatedly assured the country that Russia would be a credible partner. He said the prejudice on Russia should be set aside. Perhaps to show that all is well, the Russian government hosted a dinner for Philippine officials on board its warship, a sign of better things to come between the two countries. David Santos, CNN Philippines.
Yes, thanks, David Santos, CNN Philippines. Amazing, really, Martin. It looks like the Philippines has floated away from America and floated in towards Russia. Igor Govayev there accusing the Americans of accusing the Russians of hacking his elections. They say, well, are you some kind of banana republic?
Well, yes. I mean, there's an awful lot going on as we speak. I mean, this is the first week of 2017, and, you know, the tectonic plates are in movement.
But Americans have been struggling to control the Philippines for decades and decades. It looks
They had their own. You remember Aquino, the dictator that ran the Philippines for years on behalf of the Americans? And, of course, lots of people in the Philippines were. Aquino was later. Marcos, yeah. And, you know, people remember that.
Imelda Marcos and her famous shoes.
Her famous shoes. I mean, we are not regarded. When the CIA say, we say so-and-so is happening, and you know you can trust us, we think, well, hang on, what do we know about the CIA? What we know as historical fact about the CIA is that you've overthrown democratic regimes all over the world, in Chile, in Brazil, in Southeast Asia. You've lied and cheated and murdered and killed. And actually, you might think that the Americans at this stage of the game might say, well, we're disbanding the CIA because they've got such a bad reputation. station, we're going to set something else up which is new, and therefore we won't have to use those horrible initial CIA. They were involved in drug dealing in the Iran-Contra affair and so on. Now, in other words, they are not credible sources of information. They're professional liars. They always have been.
Well, the CNN reporter David Santos there mentioned the hacking, as did the Russian ambassador to the Philippines, Igor Govayev. And that was a subject that cropped up when Gordon Carrera from the BBC had a chat to John Brennan.
Russia was engaged in attacks on these networks to collect information, and then there was information that was released through various mechanisms on the internet.
Through WikiLeaks.
Yes, and it came out in a number of ways, and with the purpose of trying to influence the outcome. I will defer to my domestic counterparts to make a determination about whether or not things happened here domestically. I just know that from an intelligence perspective, Russia was engaged in this type of activity with a particular purpose in mind and an intent, and they were able to carry that out. The consequences and impact of that are something that I will leave to others.
Did you have any conversations with Russian counterparts about it, to challenge them over it?
Yes.
What did you tell them?
I said that this effort would backfire, that the U.S. people hold dear the democratic principles of this great country. And one of the most important tenets of this democracy is a free and fair election for our president. And that it's important for this country and for the citizens of this country to know that their election is not going to be influenced or affected by outside parties.
Do you think the warnings to Russia worked? Because I think there were some communicated through October. Do you think they actually had an impact in perhaps preventing something happening on election day?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Did you see a change of behavior, do you think, in the cyber realm after that?
Again, I would defer to my domestic counterparts, because they would be the ones with responsibility for determining what actually was taking place on U.S. soil.
What do you think the best way is of dealing with this quite aggressive Russian posture in cyberspace? I mean, cyber espionage has been going on for decades, but the release of information, kind of information warfare, what the Russians call active measures, they seem to be pushing the boundaries of that. Some people suggest that the way to respond is to do the same back. Do you think that's an effective way of dealing with it?
No, I don't think we should stoop to their level. But I think what we need to do is to make sure that they understand that engaging in these activities is unacceptable, and that there should be costs that will be incurred if they do this. And I know that the United States government has looked at various ways to determine how those costs might be levied. What you don't want to do is to engage in something that's going to lead to a spiraling
escalation
of these types of attacks. But this is where I think the U.S. government, along with our foreign partners, needs to really be thinking about how we're going to deal with this digital domain, where you can really wreak quite a bit of havoc and damage if countries, and particularly governments, do not adhere to some norms and standards, things that they will not do. This requires, I think, a very robust and broad-based discussion, not just with our foreign allies and partners, but also with other countries such as Russia and China. And we've had those discussions. There cannot just be a free rein given to countries in terms of what they are able to do in that digital domain. We are facing enough challenges with hacktivist groups and others who can ply their trade in those environments.
It's Gordon Carrera from the BBC speaking to the CIA's outgoing director, John Brennan. Martin, aggressive Russian posture in cyberspace.
Well, it's just pot calling the kettle black, isn't it? There's no evidence. He didn't produce any evidence that the Russians have hacked the election. And of course, what they said is that they hacked Podesta's emails, and then they said, and then WikiLeaks said, no, we actually got it from a leak. And they said, oh yes, but the Russians must have leaked it. So they've actually got, they can't even get the story straight.
In The Guardian, this is Owen Jones, saying the Americans could spot election meddling because they've been doing it for years.
Well, they certainly have, including in their own country. Are US elections free and fair? The answer is no, but it's not the Russians.
Also, I mentioned at the top of the hour, we'll be having another look at Operation Gladio. We do that reasonably regularly, but there's another book out about it by the US author and journalist Paul Williams.
It remains a massive, massive undertaking. Operation Gladio, in a nutshell, began with the creation of the CIA. The United States was determined. determined to stem the spread of communism throughout Europe, especially in Italy, where over 60% of the people were communist. And they were afraid of a communist takeover. And we started setting up and funding stay-behind armies. A lot of them were Nazi armies, stay-behind to combat a possible Soviet invasion of Europe. And to fund that operation, you got to realize the scope of this. They were in every country in Europe. And I'm not talking about 10 or 100, I'm talking thousands of stay-behind armies that had to be funded by us to stem and also to do away with any communist demonstrations and to subvert places, organizations like the Red Brigades. Gladio was all of that. And it ended up, and to, right now, it ended up in the hands of people who want to control the natural resources of countries throughout the world. The gladiators right now, we're still at the control of Gladio, or in Syria, or in the Middle East, or in the Ukraine. I mean, it's all a Gladio operation. Almost everything that you see, it hasn't gone away. I mean, you cannot understand the world today without coming to terms with Gladio and the people behind Gladio, who are now the international bankers and the global businessmen, that community. You really can't have any idea what's taking place, especially in a place like Syria, without coming to terms with Gladio. We've been subjected to so many false flag attacks ourselves. For instance, one thing with Gladio that stands out is the Gulf of Tonkin. In 1967, LBJ appeared on national TV, and he preempted all broadcasts, and he said there's been a major attack on the U.S. fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin, and it was an attack by the North Vietnamese, and that there are hundreds of dead sailors, their bodies are floating in the Gulf, and it's an act of war, and we have to respond. And therefore, we have that massive a military buildup and escalation of the Vietnamese conflict that, of course, ended up in complete chaos. But once again, that was a false flag attack. It never happened. Our fleet was never fired on in the Gulf of Tonkin. It was all made up. But throughout Italy, in particular during the 1970s, false flag attack mounted on false flag attack upon false flag attack. That was all blamed on the communists. And they were really perpetuated by the CIA. When you look at our history of false flag attacks and realize that, I mean, this is our heritage, you got to look really with a very cold eye at 9/11. I mean, was that a false flag attack? You got to realize that the source, the funding of all the CIA's operations, and this came out in the Kerry Commission before the Senate.
Okay, we have to finish there. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Horfield, Ollie Mead, also Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our show page for your comments and criticisms this week, .org.uk. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless you. And don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a gunman's opened fire at Fort Lauderdale Airport in southeast Florida, reportedly killing 3 people and injuring several others. The shooting happened in a baggage claim area at one of the terminals. NBC News claims the gunman's been arrested. Donald Trump has dismissed the controversy over alleged Russian hacking in the presidential election race as a political witch hunt. He's meeting intelligence officials who will present evidence of interference by Moscow. Republican commentator Jan Halper-Hayes explains.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Happy New Year. I am Malihi Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib.
That obscure feeling that you had as you left Gaza, that sore feeling, must grow into a giant one deep within you. It must expand. You must seek it in order to find yourself here among the ugly debris of defeat. I won't come to you, but you return to us. Come back to learn from Nadia's leg, amputated from the top of the thigh, what life is and what existence is worth. Come back, my friend.
This week we'll pay tribute to renowned British art critic and Palestinian rights advocate John Berger, who passed away on January 2nd. But first, we'll talk with Abdi Soltani, executive director of the ACLU in Northern California, about potential threats to the civil rights of Muslim Americans under the new Trump regime. Abdi, the specter of a Trump administration is still sinking in many segments of the U.S. population, alarmed as we have all been by some of the dangerous rhetoric consistently emanating from the candidate, and even now from President-elect Trump. I'd like to ask a number of hypothetical questions about how members of the Middle Eastern and North African communities in this country might be affected in some of the worst-case scenarios evoked by a number of influential individuals close to Donald Trump, who, by the way, has wasted little time in nominating some of the most dangerous political nominees this country has seen in a long time. So please bear with me as I ask you some of these questions might have sounded paranoid until recently, with scenarios which in real life hopefully will never even come close to materializing. Asked on MSNBC in November whether the White House should institute a database system to track Muslims in the country, Trump replied, quote, "Oh, I would certainly implement that, absolutely," end of quote. First, is that something the new president can do unilaterally? And second, what would that mean to the average Muslim American?
So in the summer of 2016, when it was apparent that Donald Trump would win the nomination of the Republican Party, the ACLU began an analysis of his statements and his positions. It's something we also did for Hillary Clinton, but obviously Donald Trump's positions on things affecting civil liberties were very controversial, and so that analysis, you know, had a lot of content. And now he has won the election. And what it is that Donald Trump will actually propose and carry out as the president, we're going to have to see. But to the point that you made about system of registering Muslims, in the analysis that we did in the summer, it's called the Trump Memos. And it's available on the ACLU website at aclu.org. We analyze the variety of proposals that he made, and one of those is the idea of a registration system based on religion. And for everything that we're going to talk about tonight, we have to remember that, you know, this is the United States of America. This is a country that had a revolution separating itself from Great Britain on a set of ideals and a set of principles. Those were stated in our Declaration of Independence, and they were also embedded in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights. First among these is the First Amendment itself, which provides for both the separation of church and state, that the Congress shall not establish a religion, and also protects the free exercise of religion. And so any type of proposal or program that targets people on the basis of religion meets that challenge of the First Amendment. There are other parts of the Constitution as well, like the Fifth Amendment guarantees us due process before our property or our liberty is taken away. The 14th Amendment provides for equal protection under the law on the basis of race. So my point simply is that it is possible that a president could propose or any of his agencies could take the steps to create such a database, but it would meet the challenge of the United States Constitution.
And yet bad things have happened over the course of 200 plus years of history that have overridden occasionally or set aside some of these protections that are in our Constitution. Witness what happened to the Japanese in World War II. What happened during the McCarthy era, et cetera, et cetera. What happened during World War II was very interesting and frightening
because the same protection applied back then. And yet, in a crisis situation, in a war kind of atmosphere, the president, the executive, was able to do quite a bit of damage that was completely oblivious to our protections. Mm. And some of that seemed to not even have been overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. So before we get into the meat of this parallel, this frightening hypothetical situation where Muslims would be rounded up, etc., or Muslim-sounding people, because that's another question, who's a Muslim? What would this registry, suppose some terrible, God forbid, terrible terrorist incident provides the excuse for Donald Trump and some of the Islamophobes around him to say, well, we don't need an act of Congress, we don't need Supreme Court, we're going to do this as we've done in the past?
Well, I think that there are a number of ways in which the government will exercise its power in a wide range of surveillance programs, of which a registry would be one. So there's the mass warrantless surveillance that of the kind that Edward Snowden exposed. The ACLU had challenged the National Security Agency over programs of that sort, but we were stymied in the courts because the courts said we can't prove that this secret program exists, and therefore we don't have standing to certify that we've been harmed. And so that case was set aside, and then Edward Snowden disclosed the nature of the widespread mass surveillance that was taking place. So, you know, you can start from the highest level, which is the broad surveillance of the whole population through telephone calls and email communications, or what's also metadata, which may not be the content of our communication, but it's who we're communicating with, when we're communicating, etc. And then you can work your way down to things that are more and more specific to a particular religious group or ethnic group. And in terms of those things that get more specific, we have had programs, for example, it's called suspicious activity reports, where people report in comments about people who they are suspicious of, and then those databases that exist are then used for other purposes, for when someone's applying for immigration or when someone's trying to go from get a green card, etc. So there are a number of programs where large amounts of information are collected. Some of those are wide enough that they are not targeted by religion. Others may end up being targeted by religion or national origin. These issues are ones that the ACLU works on. They take on different forms. We can't predict exactly what form that they'll take. But there's some legitimate law enforcement activity where law enforcement has to be able to conduct investigations and gather information. And then there are those surveillance programs that step beyond that and violate our freedom of association, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, or that are targeted by national origin, which then runs into discrimination by national origin. And so you have to tackle those that challenge some aspect of our constitutional rights.
But so specifically about this registry idea, which is quite frightening, that has been advocated by some of Trump's closest advisors, how would that work? What are they proposing to do?
You know, there are a range of proposals. I think that we have to separate statements that Donald Trump may have made or tweets that he has made from those more serious proposals and manifestations, which are the kinds of things his advisors or agency heads would put together. After 9/11, there was a program called NSEERS, which was a registration system. It was not based specifically on religion itself, but it said that if you're an immigrant in the United States on a visa or some other status, from this list of countries that happen to all be majority Muslim, then you're going to have to register with the United States government, and it was a way to monitor that population. After 9/11, large numbers of immigrants to the United States who are Middle Eastern, especially young men, were deported also en masse. So those are the types of things we've seen in the past, in the recent past. And one of our objectives between the election and the inauguration was to get President Obama to end a program, that NSEERS program. NSEERS was created during the Bush administration. They stopped using it even then, But during the Obama administration, they weren't using the program, but the shell of the program was there. And if the shell of the program is there, it can be immediately used again. And we're very pleased that, I think just last week, that program was terminated, which means that a whole new process of rulemaking has to be undertaken to create something new. You brought up Japanese-American internment, and this is a story that's very important in American history. At the ACLU of Northern California, where I have the privilege to work, we were involved in that during World War II. Fred Korematsu was a young man, I think 19 years old. He was arrested right here in the Bay Area because he refused the order to go to the Japanese internment camps. He was in a jail, and my predecessor, who was the director of the ACLU at the time here in the Bay Area, Ernest Bessig, visited him and asked if Fred would be the plaintiff in the lawsuit to challenge the internment program, and Fred agreed, which was an incredibly courageous act when we think about, we're in World War II, after Pearl Harbor, the president has issued this decree, and en masse, these are American citizens mostly, who were being taken into the camps. So that lawsuit went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and we lost that lawsuit during World War II. But that does not mean that that is a precedent that is acceptable any longer. And it's quite clear that the United States has rejected that policy. And there are other cases that preceded it that allowed for discrimination based on race. For example, there was the Chinese Exclusion Act and laws prohibiting immigration of Asiatics. So these types of things have existed in the past. We've had cases like Plessy versus Ferguson, which upheld separate but equal. But our country has moved past that. We have rejected those types of precedents, and we have stronger precedents now that provide for equal protection under the law. But even with all of what I just said, there has never been a policy of the United States or a law that excludes immigration by religion. Even with everything that I said, through the age of slavery, through the age of World War II, there's never been such a law that excludes on the basis of religion. And that's something that, if it were proposed, we would definitely challenge that.
What's not clear to me when it comes to these questions of what happened to the Japanese, all these abuses that have happened, is unconstitutional, and yet it did happen in some sort of legal framework. In those cases, how quickly can a President Trump unilaterally decide, okay, this is an emergency, we're in a war right now, it's urgent that we throw everybody we can who has any connection with Islam, from very quickly implementing the type of exclusion that happened to the Japanese? I see your point that religion has been a bigger taboo to break in terms of the history of this country. But since a lot of this happens beside the Constitution, around the Constitution, how quickly can the executive branch implement something like that? Quickly rounding up Muslims or people perceived to be Muslim, which is another big question.
I think that, I think about this is a question that came up this morning in a taxi ride, actually. And the way I answered it is I studied a lot of math and science in high school and college. And occasionally I feel like I should use a little bit of the math and science I took some time studying and now work with at the ACLU. So I think of this on two axes. There's an axis, let's say the x-axis, which deals with what is the issue or the way in which the issue is unfolding. So there we have to look at immigration is a place in which the government of the United States, it can exercise some authority to determine who's granted a visa, who's not granted a visa,
right,
who's granted a green card, who's not granted a green card, who's allowed to become a citizen, who's not. There is discretion through that process. So that's the immigration context. There's the surveillance context in which, who are we monitoring? Who are we following? Whose communications does the government seek to track? And then there's issues around incarceration, detention, who's put behind bars, et cetera. And then, so that's all in one line. And then there's a vertical axis, which is what's the method that's used and who's the actor? So at the lowest level is the practices of law enforcement agencies. FBI agents, Customs and Border Patrol agent, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. So government employees who have the badge and the power of the government and what practices they carry out, even without any new announcements, any new tweets, any new policies above them. Moving up a notch are programs that are instituted by those agencies that are just things that they can do. And then you move up from that, and there are types of programs that require a process of rulemaking, regulatory process, and that takes time, and they have to issue rules. And those can be challenged through the rulemaking process too. And then one up from that, you get into new statutes passed by the United States Congress, where you have to have the House of Representatives and the Senate, you know, agree to something that then the president signs. You know, you can go left to right, and you're dealing with, are you dealing with immigration, surveillance, or some other issue? Or you can work your way up and down, where you're dealing with either like just the straight practices, or you're dealing with all the way up a new statute. Those different things, they take different amounts of time. They have different scale. They have different levels of legitimacy. But they also pose very different challenges for civil rights advocates. If the Congress of the United States passes a statute, a law, that says we shall ban immigration on the basis of religion, that's something where you can challenge that statute as passed on its face for being against the Constitution. What's sometimes a lot harder is to challenge the practices, because for that you have to gather a lot of facts. You have to know what's happening. You have to show a pattern. And an example of a case like that that the ACLU brought in a different context than Muslim rights or the rights of Muslim Americans was what we had to do in Maricopa County in Arizona. Sheriff Joe Arpaio and the Maricopa Sheriff Department, we were hearing from community members that they were being stopped and searched for no reason other than their race. But to prove that practice takes a great deal of fact-finding and data and evidence, but ultimately a judge did rule that Sheriff Joe Arpaio was engaging in unconstitutional racial profiling. But to prove that when you're dealing with practices, it's actually a very difficult job because you have to gather a lot of facts. And that's where people come in. For any person who is listening to this program, you know, this is a great time to brush up and learn about your rights. And on the ACLU national website or the website here of ACLU of Northern California, there are a lot of resources about your rights. And it doesn't mean that every single instance the government will respect those rights, but if people know their rights, and if people know to report when their rights are violated or they suspect that their rights may have been violated, then that gives groups like the ACLU the opportunity to gather that information, collect the evidence, and then potentially bring a lawsuit against that practice.
So there are organizations like the ACLU, which are very important and do this kind of work, but the executive power of the president seems to go faster because they don't have to prove anything. An example is Executive Order 9066, issued February 1942, which allowed regional military commanders to designate military areas from which any or all persons may be excluded, and that meant the Japanese Americans. And this power was used to declare that all people of Japanese ancestry were excluded from the entire West Coast, including all of California and much of Oregon, Washington, and Arizona, except for those in government camps. So what keeps a Trump cabal from doing this very quickly and let the defense work its magic? It might take 5 years, 10 years, 20 years to beat the government. In the meantime, the damage is done.
I would say, I think that if we look on its face at what Donald Trump has said, and then some of the proposals that we've seen floating around or that one hears about, you know, there is a proposal to ban Muslim immigration. There might be a proposal to create a database of Muslims. But the idea of, you know, incarceration on the basis of religion is not something that, you know, I have personally seen proposed or heard. And if it were to be proposed, it would be, you know, something that the American public will not stand by. You know, the American people, at the end of the day, you know, power is still derived in this country as it says in our Declaration of Independence, from the consent of the governed. And we have elections every 2 years for the House of Representatives, every four for president, and then as well as for the staggered terms of the United States Senate. And the American people, they did not vote for proposals of that kind, or even the ones that we've discussed earlier. If you look at the survey data of American voters, people did not want this level of discrimination in the context of immigration or any number of issues. I think there are some economic anxieties that Donald Trump spoke to that were probably the reason people voted for him. But I think that at the end of the day, American people have goodwill. They know what the nation's values are, and I think that they will stand by them. If we face the unfortunate and horrible situation of another attack on American soil of the kind that we saw in 9/11, or even smaller terrorist attacks that take away human life, obviously there will be pressure for the government to act. And I think in those times we have to really rally together as American people in protecting our most important principles and our most important values while also providing for public safety, which we can do. And those are not values that are incompatible. We can accomplish both of those goals.
So you were earlier saying that even though these are not to be taken seriously as precedents, these things that happened to the Japanese Americans being rounded up, incarcerated, dispossessed, were never actually officially condemned by the U.S. Supreme Court or taken back in some fashion as to predictably interdict them from happening again in the future.
I think there was an interesting back and forth in the media about this, where one of the surrogates for Trump, and I don't know how closely he was associated with Trump, brought up Korematsu, and it was with on Megyn Kelly's show, and right. Megyn Kelly said, "You're not actually proposing internment." It was a very interesting exchange. So at any rate, it's just to say that if a judge wanted to use Korematsu as a precedent to justify any other action that would be happening now, I think that it would be a great embarrassment for that judge. It would be like citing Plessy versus Ferguson, which later was overturned by Brown versus Board of Education. But there are plenty of precedents in our system of law that establish a protection for the freedom of religion grounded in the First Amendment, and due process and fair treatment grounded in the Fifth Amendment, and then equal protection under the law as well. So it's not for lack of precedence for us to be able to defend these very basic principles. But I also think it's really important that the courts do not operate in a vacuum. The courts reflect the direction in which the will of the country and the nature of our values are proceeding. And I think that the progress we've made, for example, in the area of marriage equality, reflects that. The courts didn't just move on their own. And so I think this is where every person in the United States, including people of all faiths, have a stake in how these issues are resolved. This is not an issue or a question that's about just the rights of Muslim Americans. This is about these enduring principles of the freedom of religion, due process under the law, and equal protection under the law. And if there's a lesson to be learned from this nation's history or from the history of people's rights on planet Earth, it's that these principles are ones that we have to rally behind and ones that we have to give meaning through our own engagement and participation here in this country today.
So what you're saying is, one, that even in the worst hysteria and the worst kind of atmospheres of fear, this country has learned enough that it will not succumb to the same basic instincts that it did in 1942. Because in 1942, after Pearl Harbor, the first few weeks, the general atmosphere was to defend Japanese Americans as legitimate members of the society. But then the atmosphere changed after a while. The media and the whole establishment sort of turned in the wrong direction. The problem then becomes the old question of, do we have a liberal democracy where majoritarian rule does not necessarily run roughshod over our rights as individuals?
You know, there are plenty of instances in which people's rights are limited, and they range from legitimate to completely unconstitutional and illegitimate. In the legal system, if someone's rights are going to be limited, and if in particular it's going to be on the basis of religion or race, then the standard that the government must meet to justify that is exceedingly high. So there are checks in our legal system with an independent judiciary. There are checks in our legislative system. That includes the fact that we have both the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. There are checks in federalism, where there's a separation of powers between the federal government and state governments. These are all principles that our founders created in order to not concentrate power entirely in the hands of one person. That's the monarchy that the United States separated itself from. And our system of representative government is designed in order to have the protection of these basic rights in the Bill of Rights and an independent judiciary so that it's not just mob rule. There are plenty of instances in our country's history where those values were not upheld. And at the founding, slavery was in the United States Constitution too. And, you know, this country's history with slavery, this brief period of Reconstruction, and then we had the whole, you know, era of Jim Crow. You know, I don't want to paint a picture that's all, you know, that everything's fine. You know, we have this parchment that protects our rights. But there are plenty of ways in which we can work together to protect these fundamental values and protect communities, including the Muslim community or people from Middle Eastern and North African countries during this period. I think about this in relation to how might people's rights be affected. There's incarceration. And so we have in this country the highest number of incarcerated people in the world. And that's a problem that the ACLU is challenging. And that's a place where African Americans in particular face the highest rates of incarceration. Now, that's in a context of the criminal justice system. Then we have the immigration system, which is on the basis of who can enter and who can be forced to leave. And in the immigration context, there's also a very large issue of immigrant detention. We have right now in the United States soil thousands of people, including families and children, who are incarcerated while they're awaiting a hearing before an immigration judge. So that's the context of immigration. And then there's the context of our ability to express ourselves, to practice our faith freely, et cetera. So these are all issues that we're going to, you know, need to continue to work on. And the biggest point that I would make to people who are listening to this program is that this is a very important time for every person to really learn about our rights. It's important to know them, to protect them, and if they are violated, to communicate that, whether it's through social media or to a legal organization or someone else. I'd also say this is a really important time for people to join together, whether it's in a neighborhood group or through your place of worship or by joining an organization like the ACLU or similar groups, because freedom of association, that too is in the First Amendment, and we have more power acting together than if we do just working alone.
One of the freedoms that was taken away during the 1942 catastrophe, which I keep coming back to, I guess it has traumatized me and a lot of people to the point that it's hard to forget, regardless of what might or might not happen in the future. The wound has not completely healed, in my opinion. One of the rights that was taken away, and you would think that's perhaps the last right that would be tempered with in this country, is property rights. They actually also dispossessed most of the Japanese Americans who were sent to these camps, which was a double injury because these people wouldn't even have the recourse to go somewhere else to escape, to do anything with their own property. How can something like that happen in the context of this open society that has a constitution, that has an ACLU right here protecting people?
You know, how is it that that happened in the 1940s is a different question than how do we prevent something like that happening today. And the idea that on the basis of religion or just national origin, the government would come and take property. It's not going to happen. Like, there are enough checks on that from at the base level from the American people and then our elected representatives and in the executive branch that that's not my main
concern. Take property law very seriously in this country.
Yeah, property rights, but also in general, I think that those things that anything that's proposed that is targeted on the basis of religion or just national origin is so repulsive to the values of the American people broadly. And I'm not just talking about, you know, only people who voted for one candidate or another, that I think that that's where we can get a lot done. I think the more difficult area gets into a whole set of issues that we've seen unfold over really since 9/11 that get a lot more complicated. So, for example, a person who makes a charitable donation to an organization that is suspected of certain things that have not yet been proved, and they get pulled into a web of suspicion. Those are the things that get more complicated. And I think that that's the place in which things require get more technical, more complex. They affect a narrower set of people, but they affect those people in a pretty serious way. Like an example of this would be the issue of no-fly lists. The idea that there are lists of people who are not permitted to get on airplanes and have no way to get their name off that list, you know, that starts to get complicated. And it gets into a realm of work that, you know, takes some work to slog through it, as compared to challenging a Muslim registry, like I was saying before, where you can just challenge it on its face.
And again, in a timely fashion, you're saying. Of course, the complicating factor in this whole new situation is that we've never had actors like Donald Trump and his entourage. That's what seems difficult to wrap our minds around. He's very quick to dismiss all sorts of rights that are assumed to be solidly acquired, and there are rights. He surrounded himself with like-minded people, apparently, who are very extreme in their disdain for constitutional rights.
You know, you've asked about the period of Japanese-American internment in World War II, and there's also, you know, soon after World War II, we entered the Cold War, where we had a similar period of fear and hysteria. And the ACLU in the 1950s was representing people who were called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And there was a gentleman who passed away a couple of years ago who I admired greatly. His name was Al Bendick. And Al was the ACLU's one attorney in the Northern California in 1957. He was a young lawyer. And I'll take a moment to read this quote from Al. I had the chance to interview him, and we had a transcript of it that you can find on our website if you want to see his whole interview. It's worth a read. So this is what Al said. There were all kinds of committees doing investigations. We had state committees. We had a committee in California. We had the Senate Committee, the Internal Securities Committee, the House Personnel Activities Committee, and the House Un-American Activities Committee, which came here to California and subpoenaed a large number of people. And a lot of them came to the ACLU and asked to be represented. And of course, we offered to represent them. But there was only me as staff counsel, and I could not represent everyone. We went around trying to get volunteer attorneys. There was a young attorney that worked in the Mills Law Library, where I went to do my research, and we became friendly. And his name was George Moscone, and later he became mayor of San Francisco. And I asked him if he would be interested in volunteering, and he said, of course. This story of this young attorney, Al Bendick, who was the only ACLU attorney recruiting volunteers, and one of those volunteers, this young attorney named George Moscone, who agreed to serve and then went on to become the mayor of San Francisco and ultimately was assassinated as the mayor, really, for me, has been a touchstone in these weeks since the election. What I love about this story is that this was also a period of hysteria, but each person did their part. Al Bendick worked at the ACLU. He did his part. George Moscone, young lawyer in the law library, did his part. And I think that if we each do our part, whether as citizens or as non-citizens, we have the right to participate in the free life of this society. We will be able to protect our rights and our deepest values. And that's the job we have ahead of us. Donald Trump will be president of the United States. He will nominate people for cabinet positions. Many of them, probably most, will be confirmed. And it'll be our job to exercise our part in our democratic process. This is not a country where one person makes all the decisions. We all have a voice, and we better exercise that voice.
Abdi Soltani is the executive director of ACLU in Northern California. He spoke with Khalil Bendib. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. We'll be back. Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can always reach us via our website at vomena.org/blog or send us an email at info@vomena.org. You can friend us on our Facebook or find us on Twitter at twitter.com/vomena_radio. On January 2nd, the world lost John Berger, world-renowned art critic, author, and philosopher who brought intellectual rigor to the study of popular art. He's best known for his BBC TV series, Ways of Seeing. In 1982, he won the Booker Prize for fiction for his novel, G. A dedicated Marxist, John Berger also wrote on the Palestinian struggle for statehood and the exploitation of migrants in Europe. In a tribute to John Berger, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel remembered him as, quote, a great thinker with an unwavering commitment to justice. John Berger was one of the first cultural figures to join the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS movement, in 2006, urging cultural workers to not visit, exhibit, or perform in Israel. In 2008, in an address to the inaugural Palestine Festival of Literature, John Berger gave a moving reading of famed Palestinian writer Hassan Kanafani's Letter from Gaza. Kanafani was assassinated by the Israeli Mossad in 1972.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, because I don't know at what time of day you'll be listening to this. Time passes, but what makes sense of human lives stays the same. And I want to read you a short story by the great Palestinian writer, Ghassan Kanafani.
The story I want to read you, he wrote in 1955. That's to say, 7 years after the Nakba, the great expulsion of the Palestinian people from their lands. Dear Mustafa, I have now received your letter in which you tell me that you've done everything necessary to enable me to stay with you in Sacramento. I've also received news that I have been accepted in the Department of Civil Engineering in the University of California. I must thank you for everything, my friend. But it will strike you as rather odd when I proclaim this news to you. But make no doubt about it. I feel no hesitation at all. In fact, I'm pretty positive that I have never seen things so clearly as I do now. No, my friend, I've changed my mind. I won't follow you to the land where there is greenery, water, and lovely faces, as you wrote in your last letter. No, I'll stay here, and I won't ever leave. I'm really upset that our lives won't continue to follow the same course, Mustafa. For I can almost hear you reminding me of our vow to go on together, and then of the way we used to shout, "We'll get rich." But there's nothing I can do, my friend. Yeah. I still remember the day when I stood in the hall of Cairo Airport, pressing your hand and staring at the frenzied motor of the plane. And at that moment, everything was rotating in time with the ear-splitting noise of the motor. And you stood in front of me, your round face silent. Your face hadn't changed from the way it used to be when you were growing up in the Shaiya quarter of Gaza, apart from a few wrinkles. We grow up together, understanding each other completely, huh? And we promise to go on to the end. There's a quarter of an hour now, a quarter of an hour left before the plane takes off. Don't look into space like that. Listen. You'll go to Kuwait next year, and you'll save enough from your salary to uproot you from Gaza and transplant you to California. We started off together, and we must carry on. I hear you saying that to me. I hear you. And at that moment, I was watching your rapidly moving lips. Yet in an obscure way, I felt that you were not completely happy with your flight. You couldn't give 3 good reasons for it. The Ministry of Education in Kuwait had given you a contract, though it hadn't given me one. Later, in the trough of misery where I existed, you sent me small sums of money. And you knew my family's circumstances. You knew them in and out. You knew that my meager salary in the UNRWA school was inadequate to support my mother, my brother's widow, and her 4 children. Listen carefully. Write to me every day, every hour, every minute. Look, the plane's just leaving. Goodbye. Or rather, till we meet again. Later, the Ministry of Education in Kuwait gave me a contract. My life there had a gluey, vacuous quality. As though I were a small oyster lost in oppressive loneliness. There was a slipperiness to my whole life. It was only a hankering for the end of each month. And in the middle of that year, the Jews bombarded the central district of Sabha and attacked Gaza, our Gaza, with bombs and flamethrowers. I was going to leave this Gaza, leave it behind me, and go to California, where I would live for myself, my own self, which had suffered for so long. I hated Gaza and its inhabitants. Everything in the amputated town reminded me of failed pictures painted in grey by a sick man. Yes, of course, I send my mother and my brother's widow and her children a meagre sum to help them to live. But I would liberate myself from even this last tie, too. There, in green California, far from the reek of defeat, which for 7 long years had filled my nostrils. You know these feelings, because you've really experienced them. What is this ill-defined tie we had with Gaza, which nevertheless blunted our enthusiasm for flight? Why didn't we analyze the matter in such a way as to see its clear meaning? When I went on holiday in June and assembled all my possessions, longing for the sweet departure, the start towards those little things which give life a nice, bright meaning, I found Gaza, just as I had known it, was more cramped than the mind of a sleeper in the throes of a fearful nightmare, with its narrow streets, which had their bulging balconies, this Gaza. Yet what are the obscure causes that draw a man to his family, his house, his memories? Like a spring draws a small flock of mountain goats. I don't know. All I know is that I went to my mother's house that morning. And when I arrived, my late brother's wife met me and asked me, she was weeping, if I would do as her wounded daughter Nadia, now in Gaza hospital, wished me to do, and visit her that evening. Mustafa, do you know Nadia? My brother's beautiful 13-year-old daughter. That evening, I bought a pound of apples and set out for the hospital to visit Nadia. I knew that there was something about it that my mother and my sister-in-law were hiding from me. I loved Nadia. I loved her from habit, the same habit that made me love all of that generation, which had been so brought up on defeat and displacement that it had come to think that a happy life was a kind of social deviation. I entered the white room, very calm. Ill children have something of saintliness, and how much more so if the child is ill as a result of cruel, painful wounds. Nadia was lying on her bed, her back propped up on a pillow, over which her hair was spread like a thick belt. There was a profound silence in her wide eyes, and a tear always shining in the depths of her black pupils. Her face was calm and still, but eloquent, as the face of a tortured prophet might be. And Nadia was still a child, but she seemed more than a child, much more. And older than a child. Much older. Nadia? I've no idea whether I was the one who said it, or whether it was someone else behind me, but she raised her eyes to me, and I felt them dissolve me like a piece of sugar that has fallen into a hot cup of tea. And together with her slight smile, I heard her voice. Uncle, have you just come from Kuwait? Then her voice broke in her throat, and she raised herself with the help of her hands and stretched out her neck towards me. I patted her back and sat down near her. Nadia, look, I brought you presents from Kuwait, lots of presents. I'll wait till you can leave your bed completely well and healed, and then you'll come to my house, and I'll give them to you. I bought you the red trousers you wrote and asked me for. Yes, I bought them. It was a lie, born of the tense situation. But as I uttered it, I felt that I was speaking the truth for the first time. Nadia trembled, as though she had had an electric shock, and lowered her head in a terrible silence. I felt her tears wetting the back of my hand. Say something, Nadia, say something. Don't you want the red trousers? She lifted her gaze to me and made as if to speak, but then she stopped, gritted her teeth, and I heard her voice again, coming from far away. Uncle, she stretched out her hand, lifted the white coverlet with her fingers, and pointed to her leg, amputated from the top of the thigh. I went out of the hospital in Gaza that day. The blazing sun filled the streets with the color of blood, and Gaza was brand new, Mustafa. You and I never saw it like this. The stones piled up at the beginning of the Shahia quarter, where we lived, had a meaning. This Gaza in which we had lived, and with whose good people we had spent 7 years of defeat, was something new. It seemed to me just a beginning. I don't know why I thought it was just a beginning. I imagined that the main street that I walked along on the way back home, yeah, I imagined it was only the beginning of a long, long, long road leading to Safad. Everything in this Gaza throbbed with sadness, which was not confined to weeping. It was a challenge. More than that, it was something like reclamation of the amputated leg. I went out into the streets of Gaza, streets filled with blinding sunlight. And they told me that Nadia had lost her leg when she threw herself on top of her little brothers and sisters to protect them from the bombs and flames that had fastened their claws into the house. Nadia could have saved herself. She could have got out, run away, rescued her leg, but she didn't. Why? No, my friend, I won't come to Sacramento, and I've no regrets. No. And nor will I finish what we began together in childhood. That obscure feeling that you had as you left Gaza, that small feeling must grow into a giant one deep within you. It must expand. You must seek it in order to find yourself here, among the ugly debris of defeat. I won't come to you. But you, return to us. Come back to learn from Nadia's leg, amputated from the top of the thigh, what life is and what existence is worth. Come back, my friend. We're all waiting for you.
English art critic and longtime supporter of Palestine, John Berger died on Monday, January 2nd, at the age of 90, at his home in Paris. In 2008, John Berger gave a moving reading of famed Palestinian writer Hassan Kanafani's letter from Gaza. Kanafani was assassinated by the Israeli Mossad in 1972. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
CUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate change. The melting of high mountain glaciers. Among these melting glaciers are 98% of the named Alaskan and European glaciers. The Institute of Tibetan Plateau Research studies 612 glaciers. 95% of them are retreating.
These glaciers are dying. They're remnants of another climate on our planet.
When I first met Dr. Lonnie Thompson in December 2007, he reported on his expedition to Mount Kilimanjaro, where they had drilled ice cores 7 years earlier to ascertain the age and thickness of the glacier. In November 2009, he gave an urgent update in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, writing that the dramatic loss of Kilimanjaro's ice cover has attracted global attention. The three remaining ice fields are both shrinking laterally and rapidly thinning by 26% within the last decade alone. The Kilimanjaro glaciers are 11,700 years old. Thompson says they will have disappeared by 2033 if the current rate of melting continues. In December 2009, NASA climatologist James Hansen called attention again to the glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau. They are sometimes called the Earth's third pole because they hold the largest ice mass outside the polar regions and act as water storage for South and East Asia, providing fresh water to more than a billion people. Hansen and the co-authors of the December 2009 paper on black soot in the troposphere and on the surface of the Tibetan glaciers say that these glaciers have been melting at an accelerating, alarming rate over the past decade, raising the threat that many of them could be gone by mid-century.
If you go over to Tibet, many of the major rivers have their source up on the Tibetan Plateau and in the Himalayas. The Himalayan glaciers store about 12,000 cubic kilometers of fresh water in about 15,000 glaciers and are the lifeline for millions of people.
Professor Lonnie Thompson is a paleoclimatologist. He has achieved global recognition for his drilling and analysis of ice cores from mountain glaciers. I recorded him in 2007 and updated the program in 2009. The accelerated melting of the years since 2009 and the ever louder voices of climate change deniers challenged me to do another update. It's now early 2017. I also want to do a shout-out to Professor Lonnie Thompson. He since had a heart transplant and, against all medical advice, has continued his field work on glaciers, often at elevations where healthy and much younger people succumb to altitude sickness. All this and more will be covered in the upcoming TUC radio programs on the melting of the inland ice. I'm beginning with a rebroadcast of his December 2007 keynote speech for the American Geophysical Union. To accommodate the huge audience, The talk was held in the ballroom of a San Francisco hotel. I got there early to set up at the long press table and connect with the audio engineer. Both of us were amazed that not a single media organization made a recording that night. Here's my 2007 introduction. Dr. Lonnie Thompson saw one of the first ice cores that was recovered from a glacier when he was in graduate school. He was fascinated by the amount of data on Earth history, past climate, and world-changing events that can be read from these ice cores, and made the exploration of ice his life's work. He teaches in the Department of Geological Sciences and is senior research scientist at the Byrd Polar Center at Ohio State University. He came to San Francisco in early December 2007 to issue a warning that the glaciers he knows and loves are melting. Here is Dr. Lonnie Thompson.
I want to talk about abrupt climate change and our future, and I'm going to start with kind of a background. But if you look at the definitions of abrupt climate change, there's a physical definition, a translation of the climate system from one regime to a distinctly different one on a timescale that is faster than the responsible forcing. But then there is a societal or ecological definition, and that is a climatic change that takes place so rapidly and unexpectedly that human and the natural systems have difficulty adapting to it. I want to talk about glaciers. Among the first responders to global warming, they serve both as indicators and drivers of climate change. Evidence for abrupt climate change, past and present. Evidence for a recent acceleration in the rate of ice loss in the tropics. A clear and present danger. I've spent over 30 years looking at the record in ice, and we have tremendous records now coming from the polar regions, the very deep cores from East Antarctica, and we have now a number of high-resolution records coming from the high mountain regions around the world, and I'll be talking mainly about those. The ice core work is really interdisciplinary, and it records not only climate, things like temperature and net balance accumulation through time, but it also records a lot of the forcings of climate, changes in volcanic activity, the greenhouse gases trapped in the air bubbles. It's a wonderful archive of our past. If we look at the changes in our atmosphere, Charles Keeling's curve, we're currently about 382 parts per million by volume, CO2 rising 1.5 to 2 parts per million by volume each year. And the ice cores have allowed us to put that curve into a perspective. And the ice and the bubbles in the ice has archived that history. If you look at the changes since 1750, back before industrialization, you can see what the natural levels were, about 280 parts per million by volume, and we're now over 100 parts per million by volume higher than that. We know the sources. If you look at the increase in CO2, 80% of it's coming from the burning of gas, oil, and coal, another 20% coming from biomass burning. So if we look at where we are today with these greenhouse gases, and then we look at where we're projected to be in less than 100 years with our business as usual models. And, of course, CO2 remains in the atmosphere 70 to 120 years once it's released. So the question is, what will that do to the climate of our planet? And IPCC can take those same models and project what those changes might be, and that range, the most recent assessment is somewhere between 2 and 4.5 degrees C with a mean of about 3 degrees C warming. And is that significant? And it certainly is when you look at the temperature of the Earth, and the temperature changes as you go through one of these glacial cycles. To go from a time when we have ice cover and Columbus, Ohio is under a mile thick ice sheet, we're talking about a 6 degree C temperature change. And what we're looking at is in less than 100 years, a temperature rise of on average 3 degrees So it is significant. And then you ask, well, how far back in a geologic record do you have to go to find when temperatures were 2 to 3 degrees warmer? And you have to go back to the Pliocene, almost 3 million years ago. And then if you ask what was sea level 3 million years ago, you're talking 25 to 35 meters higher than today. These are very significant changes. The ice cores provide a unique history from regions where other recording systems are missing, records from Antarctica and Greenland, but also from the very highest mountain regions of the world. Over the last 30 years, we've been working to put together kind of a global picture of climate as recorded in ice. And we have many, many wonderful paleoclimate recorders, and they all add to our history in developing that history. I'm going to take you to one of these sites just to give you an idea of how these records are produced. In 2003, we drilled Quelccaya ice cap down in the Andes of Peru and also Coropuna in southern Peru. Quelccaya ice cap is the largest tropical ice cap on Earth. The elevation here, the summit, is 18,650 meters. It's the one that has these very distinct annual layers, and it has a very distinct history preserved in it. We've spent a lot of time in engineering, developing lightweight, portable systems that can run on solar power, multiple energy sources, to recover these cores from remote parts of the world. Those are brought back frozen to the labs at Ohio State, and their history is developed. And just to give you an idea of how that history is preserved, just look at two parameters here, the stable isotopes of oxygen and dust. Every year in the tropics where you have a wet and dry season, you have a dust layer. And if you look at these, you'll see that time is getting compressed as you go back in time. Here we are 1520 to 1560. The Spanish arrived in this part of the world in 1531, and that's where we have the first written records from that part of the world. You can go back to 1240 to 1330, back to 660 to 800, in a part of the world where we have hardly any information of how the system has worked. Put it together, you get a history, an annual history, going back 315 AD. And if you look at this, you can see events that we know of in the northern hemisphere, the medieval warm period, the Little Ice Age, where you have more depleted isotopes. You can see major volcanic eruptions, like the eruption of Huayna-Pitina in February 17th to March 3rd, 1600. It's in the church records, and it gives us a time check on our chronologies. So they're wonderful records. Now, you can put these together and come up with a composite for the tropics. If you look at the three cores from the Andes, they go back and you look at the decadal averages over the last 2,000 years, you can again see in these cores the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age and enrichment in the 20th century. If you combine those, you kind of capture the tropics, and the tropics cover 50% of the surface of our planet. And then you can compare that with other paleoclimate reconstructions from the northern hemisphere, and you see a lot of similarities in these curves back through time. But what really stands out is the last 80 years in the record, and that's the isotope history. But glaciers record climate in other ways, and one of the ways is what's actually happening to the ice. So I want to take you very quickly around the world to show some changes that have occurred in recent time. If you look at the 700 glaciers in southeast Alaska that have been named, of those, 98% of them are retreating. There's about a dozen that are actually advancing. And you see similar stories if you go to the Himalayas. Yao Tang Dong and the Institute of Tibetan Plateau Research, they're studying 612 glaciers in Tibet. Of those, from 1990 to 2005, some 95% of them were retreating. You can go to the Alps, you can see the change that's taking place in that part of the world. Over 98% of the glaciers being monitored in the Alps are losing their mass, the same story. In Kilimanjaro, the oldest photos there were taken back in 1912, and those are actually glaciers. You have to be careful when you look at mountains to make sure you're looking at ice and not a snow cover. But those are glaciers in 1912. 1970, a photo from Bruno Messerli, and then by 2000 when we went there to drill. And the people who lived here have watched the ice retreat up this mountain. These glaciers are dying. They're remnants of another climate on our planet. If you go over to Tibet, and this is a very important part of the world. Many of the major rivers have their source up on the Tibetan Plateau and in the Himalayas. The Himalayan glaciers store about 12,000 cubic kilometers of fresh water in about 15,000 glaciers and are the lifeline for millions of people. And our most recent site was over here, Nanu Nami. It's about a five-day journey west of Lhasa. It's at the source of the Indus River, the Ganges River, and the Brahmaputra River. And in 2006, we drilled three cores to bedrock. Now, one of the first things we do when we get the cores back is that we look at all the thermonuclear bomb tests that human beings have done. And all the glaciers that we have drilled to date, Adunda, Galia, Dasupu, and Puragangri, you can see the 62, 63 Soviet test in the beta radioactivity. We determine that, we can determine accumulation rate. When we looked at the cores from Nanu Nami, it's not there. Then the next thing we do is we look for the IV test, the 5152 US test. We look at chlorine-36, working with our colleagues Jörg Beer at the ETH facility in Switzerland. And you can see this on ice cores, previous ice cores drilled around the world. But on Nanu Nami, it's not there. That tells us at the top of this glacier, there has been no accumulation or a net loss since at least 1950. And if you look at Kilimanjaro, when we drilled in 2000, this layer was 1.8 meters below the surface. Had we waited until 2006, it wouldn't have been there either. So these glaciers are wasting from the surface down, and they're at the source, in many cases, of major water supplies for people. You go down to the Andes of South America, the longest documented glacier now is Quillacollo. And if you look at what's happening in that part of the world, you can see that it's not just retreating. There's an exponential increase. In the first 15 years of measurement, the terminus is retreating about 6 meters per year. In the last 15 years, it's been over 60 meters per year, a tenfold increase. So glaciers, especially tropical glaciers, are the canaries in the coal mine for our global climate system as they integrate and respond to most of the key climatological variables such as temperature, precipitation, cloudiness, humidity, and radiation. Global glacier retreat at the beginning of the 21st century is driven mainly by increasing temperatures, although regional factors such as deforestation can play a role in any given site. Now, the problem is when you look at this, and if you're a skeptic on climate change, you'll say, well, you know, glaciers have changed through time. So how do you know this is unusual? Well, occasionally you can find older photographs, and you can overlap those photos, and you can see where glaciers have disappeared. You can see it's not only area, but thickness of glaciers that are being lost. But this is still a relatively short period of time. So can you do better? This is a quote from Sir Ernest Shackleton in 1915. What the ice gets, the ice keeps. And he was talking about his ship, the Endurance, that led to this epic journey out of Antarctica. But it's true for ice itself. Anything that is buried in the ice is preserved. And as the glaciers retreat, these things are coming out. And I'm only going to give a couple examples of this. On the Quillacollo ice cap, as this glacier retreats, this is recently exposed land. This is a lake that didn't exist back in 1977. And in 2002, on the backside of this lake, we found a plant deposit. And this is a wetland plant deposit, perfectly preserved. It came out of the retreating margin of the ice cap. And the amazing thing is how fast this ice can disappear. And other plants have come out. We now have collected over 50 specimens, and these can be carbon dated. Distichia muscoides is the plant, and you can see the age is 5,200 years. So that's tell us that this ice cap hasn't been smaller for at least 5,200 years, otherwise this plant would have decayed. And if you look around the world, there are other things coming out of the ice. You've probably heard of Ötzi, the Iceman. Came out of the Austrian Alps in 1991. Interesting thing about this man is he's the same age as the plants down in the Andes in Peru. I want to come back to the modern world and look at two areas where the Earth is warming most rapidly, and that's in the high latitudes. And if you look at the Antarctic Peninsula, the temperatures there have risen about 2 degrees C over the last 50 years. If you look at Antarctica as a whole, altimeter data indicate that East Antarctica is thickening with increased snowfall and surface cooling. It's work by Jay Zawali. Locally on Pyatt Island and Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica, there's a thinning taking place, which is 0.75 to 2.5 meters per year, and that's accelerating. And the GRACE satellite data from 2002 to 2005, if you take Antarctica as a whole, it's losing mass and contributing to sea level rise. If you go to the north, to Greenland, very dramatic changes taking place there. Formation of these meltwater lakes and the expansion of the melt zones on this ice cap. Water moving through moulins, lubricating the base of the glacier, and a noted, measured increase in the rate at which the ice is flowing into the ocean. And one example of one of these large outlet glaciers is the Jakobshavn ice stream, which drains about 6.5% of the Greenland ice sheet. And this shows the position of the terminus back in 1850 coming forward. And you can see it was stable from 1953 to 2000, but just recently has started to accelerate. And if you look at the rate of change, between 2000 and 2003, the speed doubled, and there has been a thinning of 120 meters on surface from 1997 to 2003. So very large change. The other thing is that we see this happening with a lot of the outlet glaciers shown here, and the question is, when will you start seeing it to some of the outlet glaciers further to the north? Yesterday, Mark Serez gave a great lecture talking about sea ice. And again, this is something that's been in the news a lot this year. And if you look at that, the satellite data from 1979 coming forward to 2006, the change this year it has been tremendous. And all the modelers and the people I've talked to did not expect to see such rapid change. It's like it's fallen off a cliff. And there's talk of tipping points. Are there tipping points in the climate system? And would you know if you crossed the tipping point, or when would you know? And probably you would only know it when you see it in the rear view mirror. So if you look at the world as a whole, the 20th and 21st century, we're losing ice. All these red areas show a loss of ice. And so climatologically, we are in unfamiliar territory, and the world's ice cover is responding dramatically to these changes. And, of course, the concern has to do with sea level rise and how that might change. Sea level is rising currently in around 3.1 plus or minus 0.7 millimeters per year. We know this is due to, in part, thermal expansion of the oceans as oceans warm. Alpine glacier mass loss, and if you would lose all the alpine glaciers, and plus look at thermal expansion, you'll be looking at a sea level rise of about 0.5 meters. We're losing mass, is our best measurements that we can tell from both of the major ice sheets, and we're pumping more groundwater for irrigation than is going back into those systems. So sometimes it's best to look at, you know, what's the worst case scenario? You say, how much could sea level rise? If you lost all the ice in East Antarctica, you could get 55 to 60 meters. If you lose West Antarctica, you get an additional 5 to 6 meters. And if you looked at Greenland, you could get 6 to 7 meters if you lose that ice sheet on top of that. So there's a lot of water stored on land in today's world. These are potentially huge changes that we face in a fairly short period of time. So I want to talk a little bit about society and our response to these changes and what our options are. And this is what I think our options are. We can talk about prevention, which means measures to reduce the pace and the magnitude of climate change in the global climate being caused by human activities. And examples of this would be prevention, including reducing greenhouse gas emissions, enhancing the sinks for these gases. We could talk about geoengineering to counteract the warming effects of greenhouse gases. You know, these are kind of our options. Adaptation, which means taking measures to reduce the adverse impacts on human well-being that result from climate changes that do occur. Examples of this would be adaptation with changing agricultural practices, strengthening defenses against diseases, climate-related diseases, and building more dams and dikes, but this is a moving target, and we don't know exactly how the different regions are going to be impacted. And the last is suffering. That is the adverse impacts that are not avoided by either mitigation or adaptation. And the history of man would say that, you know, who pays the price for change? Well, it's usually those who are least able to adapt, and in this particular case, who are least responsible. This is a Quechua Indian girl that lives just below the Calcaya ice cap down in the Andes in Peru. So if I was to go over the key points from this presentation, they would be that the 20th century is the warmest in the last 2,000 years as recorded in low-latitude ice cores, and in several places the warmest in over 5,000 years. Ice cores provide a unique information that extends our knowledge of the Earth's climate history. Climatologically, we're in unfamiliar territory, and the world's ice cover is responding dramatically to that. The observed rapid changes that we're currently seeing in Greenland and Antarctica are not predicted by our climate models. They call for slow, linear response, and what we're seeing is fast glacier flow, and we haven't included that. Glaciers in most parts of the world are rapidly melting, and their loss will affect 2 to 3 billion people, and a valuable paleoclimate archive will be lost forever. Glaciers are our most visible evidence of global warming. They integrate many of the climate variables in the Earth system. Their loss is readily apparent, and they have no political agenda. So it brings us to our Earth, and if we've learned anything from our space program, is how unique the planet is for the life as we know it. And I like to think about, you know, what it is that we as human beings might do, and when might we do it. But you can ask the question for this issue. Given that greenhouse gases last average residence time 70 to 120 years, if we behave the way that we have in the past and we wait for that crisis, we've already built in a whole series of crises. And then you have to ask what it would take, what that crisis would be. Certainly wasn't the heat wave that hit Europe in 2003 that killed over 30,000 people. Could be something like back-to-back Category 5 hurricanes hitting the same place if it was a major city. You know, what would it take to get the attention to put us all on the same page on this issue? But what is very clear here is that for the issue of global warming, nature is a timekeeper, and none of us can see the clock. So thank you very much. It's my pleasure to have an opportunity to speak to you tonight. Thank you.
That was Dr. Lonnie Thompson. He teaches in the Department of Geological Sciences and is senior research scientist at the Byrd Polar Center at Ohio State University. Most of his work of the last several decades has focused on tropical glaciers and the climate information that they contain. He and his wife were recipients of a 2007 Distinguished Explorer Award. Even though he was awarded the prestigious 2007 National Medal of Science, no other broadcast or TV media attended the talk that you just heard. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This is our 2016 year in review episode.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit by the Groundwire National Coordination Team in Toronto.
We are your hosts,
Noreen Ramdullah
and David Knapp. And this is the 2016 Groundwire Year in Review episode, where we highlight some of the most significant news stories covered by Groundwire this past year.
From coast to coast, Leelu Island to Muskrat Falls, this past year marked by Indigenous resistance to pipelines, condo developments, and dam construction. Here are some highlights from this past year's coverage by Groundwire.
In January, Gunargi O'Sullivan of CFRO spoke with Big Fire Woman about Leelu Island, a A resistance camp was established by hereditary chiefs on Lilu Island to protect the water and salmon in August of 2015. The camp continues to this day, despite pressure from the Prince Rupert Port Authority to shut it down.
The people of your territory voted 100% against the project, yet they continue to drill on Flora Banks. Is that so?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's been challenging. Like, if you actually, I did my research and I was able to find the actual certificate issued by the Canadian government allowing for the investigative work to take place. And part of the conditions on that certificate states that they will no longer be able to do their surveys if they are met with First Nations people who are asserting their right to live the land.
Yeah.
So technically, all of their work right now should be stopped because of the people out on Lilu Island who are supporting Yohan, the chief of the Gitwilgiat.
Okay.
Tried to protect the salmon estuary, which is Flora Banks, and it's the second biggest estuary in Canada. So our wild salmon on the northwest coast here is something that's very unique. It's in very high demand on the market, and I believe it's something that is worth protecting.
Despite Indigenous resistance and environmental concerns, the Northwest LNG project received federal approval in September 2016. In December, it was announced that Petronas is now reconsidering the location of the Pacific Northwest LNG project.
In March, an injunction and civil lawsuit was launched against water protectors who blocked construction of the Site C dam for 62 days. Gunargi O'Sullivan recorded Yvonne Tupper, a member of Treaty 8, responding to the Supreme Court injunction at a press conference in Vancouver.
BC Hydro and the BC government need to start looking at culture competencies and start learning about Indigenous peoples and treaty rights. We're a named number treaty in the northeast of BC, which is unique than other Aboriginal titles of BC. We have a large area mass of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Northwest Territories. And to learn about us through this process, we have 40 years of saying no from other political First Nations throughout the years. This is nothing new for us, but here to have a Supreme Court ruling, we're not here to not obey it. We're here to obey it. But I knew that this is not the forum for it.
In December, BC Hydro announced that they would be expropriating Ken and Arlene Boone's family farm to construct the dam. Meanwhile, in November, the Supreme Court of BC rejected a petition by two First Nations to overturn provincial permits issued for the Site C dam on the basis of inadequate consultation.
In July, demonstrations took place in Ottawa against the development of the Zibi condos and lack of consultation of Algonquin people on this unceded territory. Matt Cicero of CKCU reported from a sacred walk to stop the development on Chaudière Island.
Elders and activists spoke about the importance of protecting the falls. Jane Ann Chartron is an Algonquin elder from Algonquin Park.
We should have a place where we can go, where it is sacred, where it has been sacred for thousands and thousands of years. We are here because of the next seven generations. Of your people and my people, to join hands in unity, to paddle both sides of the river in harmony. And remember, you can't paddle that canoe alone. It'll upset you. You might get wet. We need to unleash Chaudière. We must release the falls.
In December, Kitigan Zibi Chief Jean-Guy White Duck announced an Ontario Supreme Court challenge claiming title to much of the unceded lands in Ottawa, including Parliament Hill and the island where Zibi condo developments are underway.
On the East Coast, water protectors occupied the Naucor Muskrat Falls construction site in October, voicing concerns over methylmercury contamination of the water. The project has been opposed by all three Indigenous governments in Labrador, and resistance has also included hunger strikes by three Inuit water protectors. The Supreme Court issued an injunction order that prohibited protesting at the Muskrat Falls Gate. GroundWire's Carly Forbes recorded Lonzi Michelin speaking at a solidarity rally in Ottawa.
This dam has been a mistake from the very beginning.
billions of dollars over budget, years behind schedule. And because of this, the provincial government thinks that they can cut corners and skip over important environmental mitigation.
Billy Gauthier, who was on hunger strike during the peak of the opposition to Muskrat Falls, also spoke at the rally.
And our people, all of our peoples, should be able to live on the lands in our traditional ways and actually be able to keep our pride, because our pride is what's keeping us standing, and our pride is what's going to keep us standing in the future. And we will make Muskrat right. We will.
A deal was struck between the Labrador government and Indigenous leadership that led to some additional environmental protections in the dam construction. Community opposition to the Muskrat Falls construction continues, with a rally taking place on New Year's Day at the gates of the construction site.
In 2016, approval was given for the Trans Mountain and Line 3 pipelines, while the Northern Gateway pipeline was rejected. The National Energy Board is set to restart hearings on the Energy East pipeline in 2017. Stay tuned to Groundwire for continued coverage of Indigenous resistance in the upcoming year.
Across Canada, migrants are jailed indefinitely without charge or trial forthcoming because Canada cannot deport them but will not release them. This means that many are locked up behind bars and separated from their families for years on end. Canada is a rogue nation going against legal frameworks in other countries which restrict the length of time migrants can be detained pending deportation. Migrants are unjustly imprisoned in maximum security prisons, and the United Nations has found that they do not have access to adequate judicial oversight. Adequate medical care is consistently denied. As a result, migrants are suffering, are separated from their families, and many are dying. During 2016, Groundwire has covered stories of migrant detentions and resistance. Here's a sample of what was covered.
Since Monday, July 11th, 60 brown and black men on immigration detention have been hunger striking from within the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, and the Toronto East Detention Center in Scarborough, Ontario. The immigration detainees, who have been organizing for their freedom since 2013, are demanding to meet with the Minister of Public Safety, Ralph Goodall. They want an end to indefinite immigration detention and believe Goodall can make that happen. Sharmeen Khan of the End Immigration Detention Network explains why detainees are fed up and how people end up in indefinite immigration detention.
This is the second hunger strike that many detainees have gone on. The first one was in 2013, and they started the hunger strike again yesterday for one simple demand. They want to have a meeting with the minister, Ralph Goodall, who's the Minister of Public Safety and who is the new Liberal minister in that portfolio. And they are insisting that they meet with him to talk about their conditions in detention and how it is indefinite. So when they can't be deported, they are held indefinitely in these detention centers, which are maximum security prisons.
We also spoke to an unnamed detainee who explained why he is striking along with his fellow inmates at the Central East Correctional Center.
I am taking part in the hunger strike because I was taught, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. With that being said, in life, you have to make sacrifices to get your point across, to reach your demand, and to let them know how serious this matter is to us. And that will take drastic measures to fight for the better of our people and for a better cause, and hopefully they take heed and treat us like fairly like human beings.
Both Khan and the detainees stress that immigration detainees face deplorable prison conditions not seen in other ranges.
The conditions in Lindsay are quite bad. When there's a staffing issue, the prisons go into lockdown, and that means they, you know, locked in their cells sometimes for 18 to 21 hours a day. They also get different food, often worse food than the rest of the prison, and they don't have full access to health care, legal access, like legal visits and family visits. When they are released out of their cells, sometimes not even allowed to go outside. So some don't see fresh air for days. They only go into a larger cell, maybe to walk around a bit.
The prison conditions are horrible, to be honest. The rooms are freezing cold. We don't get treated like a regular human. On holidays, we are supposed to get a hot tray all three meals. But on Canada Day, we got our regular cold trays in the morning and afternoon.
While Ralph Goodall has commented on the issue, Khan stresses that his viewpoint is not reassuring. At this point, the detainees are committed to continuing their strike until a meeting is set with the MP. This is Mina reporting from CFRU 93.3 FM.
On October 17th, 17 immigration detainees imprisoned in the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, began refusing food. The immigration detainees are calling for an end to indefinite detention with a 90-day limit on detentions. This is the third hunger strike that immigration detainees have been on this year. In the last 6 months, three men have died in immigration detention in Canada. The most recent hunger strike ended on August 15th after promises were made by Federal Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodall on a new national immigration detention strategy. In a statement published by the End Immigration Detention Network, one of the detainees on hunger strike spoke on behalf of the 17, stating,
"We have been on hunger strike twice this year, most recently for 19 days, at the end of which we were promised real change. The minister went on the record and said that immigration detention is broken, but he did not specify long-term and indefinite detention, which impacts many of us, separating us from our families and making us sick. Consultations were promised and yet have not taken place directly with detainees. While we are the primary stakeholders, we want an end to indefinite detention. We don't want to be locked up in maximum security prisons. We want real access to effective legal remedies to contest our detention."
Many of the immigration detainees are imprisoned indefinitely without charges or trial. Limits on arbitrary detention are recommended by the United Nations and are law in the U.S. and the European Union.
We'll be right back after this music break.
We are the tribe that they cannot see. We live on an industrial reservation. We are the Halusa Nation. We have been called the Indians. We have been called Native American. We have been called hostile. We have been called pagan. We have been called militant. We have been called many names. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the human beings. The callers of names cannot see us, but we can see them. We are the Halusa Nation. Our DNA is of earth and sky. Our DNA is of past and future. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the evolution, the continuation. The Halusa Nation.
You just heard We Are the Halusa Nation by A Tribe Called Red, featuring John Trudell and Northern Voices, off their new album of the same name.
Black Lives Matter is an international activist movement that seeks justice from state-sanctioned violence against black people and fights ingrained anti-black racism in our societies. Canada's Black Lives Matter movements and the voices of black activists brought national attention to issues such as police carding and the targeting of black youth by Toronto police, police brutality, and murder of black men such as Andrew Locu and Jermaine Carby, and the systemic racism and violence towards black students on university campuses. Here's a review of some of the Black Lives Matter and other black solidarity movements covered by Groundwire this past year. The resistance against Vice Canada's representation of Somali communities in Toronto, and the Black Lives Matter stoppage of this year's Pride Parade.
On May 24th, Vice Canada released This is Dixon, a documentary that explores the post-Rob Ford anti-Somali sentiments in Dixon and throughout Canada. Dixon is a neighborhood in northwest Toronto that is home to a large Somali community, one of the biggest diasporas in Canada. Reactions to the Vice documentary by progressive Somalis was enraged, as the documentary reproduces the very same vile and violent myths about Somali Canadians that the Toronto police uses to legitimize its surveillance and violence within the community, such as the police raids in June 2013. Over the past month, in response to the documentary, Somali community members have led a campaign on social media under the hashtag That's Not Dixon to call upon Vice to remove the anti-black documentary from circulation and to adopt anti-racist accountability within their productions, focusing specifically on anti-blackness. Udbi is a Somali community organizer.
The documentary produces what is two decades of the City of Toronto and national Canadian institutions, often led by media reports vilifying the Somali community, and comes in the aftermath of similar mistreatments of the Jamaican community. The narrative Vice uses is not new. It reproduces the same historical abuses on the Somali community we have experienced by Canadian institutions, media, and the police. The documentary must be placed in a broader context of anti-Black racism by the Canadian media.
Additionally, since the documentary itself was not even produced by Somalis, but rather outsiders from the United States, the community has been calling on Vice, and indeed other media outlets, to commission work from members of the Somali community to tell their own stories.
Back in July, Black Lives Matter protested the police presence in Pride Toronto. Mick Sweetman of CJRU now brings us coverage from a recent Pride Toronto town hall meeting.
On August 30th, hundreds of people attended a Pride Toronto town hall meeting where the discussion centered on Black Lives Matter Toronto's demand that police no longer be allowed to have floats or booths at the festival. At the meeting, the board members of Pride Toronto sat silently at the front of the room, listening to people address them at the open mic. The next day, I sat down with one of Pride's co-chairs to talk about what she heard from the community. We're joined here today with Alika Hall, who is one of the co-chairs of Pride Toronto. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
At the first town hall meeting, things got a little heated. Can I ask what your thoughts are, having watched that town hall meeting play out last week?
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of things yesterday that gave us pause and food for thought. I think it's just thinking through what processes and mechanisms we can put in place to ensure that people do feel like how they feel, what they think about Pride, what they want to see more of is actually reflected in there. Because I think that we don't have as many opportunities as we'd like to actually engage with community beyond the festival. And so creating additional spaces and as well as processes and ways for people to just contribute, I think will be really key for us moving forward.
One of the things that you said at the first town hall was that what the demand around police floats and booths was going to be treated as a complaint and dealt with in the dispute resolutions committee. Can you tell me why the board chose to use that process?
So the dispute resolution process was actually created for this exact scenario, when a group or an individual has a complaint or concern about the participation of another group in the Pride Parade. So I think as an organization, we would rely on a mechanism that was created by both community members as well as with the support of council and in consultation with the City of Toronto's policies to use a mechanism that already exists for our organization and has been actually used a number of times in the past year, as opposed to embarking on a process to do something differently or new.
One of the more specific demands around Pride Toronto was that Pride Toronto double the funding for Blockorama. Is that something that Pride Toronto is prepared to do?
Yes, that's something that Pride Toronto wants to do. And the organization, Pride Toronto, as I said today and yesterday at both town halls, is fully committed to working with Black queer organizations to do that.
One theme that kept reemerging at the meeting was that people were calling on Pride to return to its activist roots. Those roots are the confrontational protests of the bathhouse raids in 1981, where hundreds of people stood up against the Toronto police's mass arrest of gay people.
Since April 1st, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe have organized the Sacred Stone Camp to resist the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, USA. If built, the pipeline would have passed under the Missouri River twice and run over the Sioux tribe's sacred sites and burial ground. The Department of the Army did not approve an easement that would allow the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline to cross under Standing Rock Sioux tribe land, forcing the pipeline to find alternative routes and may see the end of the project altogether. The success against the Dakota Access Pipeline serves as an important inspiration for other struggles that continue. The Obama and Trudeau administrations have approved several other pipeline projects slated to run across Indigenous territories from Canada to the U.S. and Mexico. The struggle to protect sacred lands from climate change, toxic pollution, and fossil fuel industry continues to rage around the world. In the year ahead, the energy and support for the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline should be extended and continues to inspire other Indigenous communities in their local battles, such as the Copper One Rivière Dorée mine in Quebec,
Line 3 Pipeline in Alberta, Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline, and others. Here are some highlights of Groundwire's coverage of solidarity with Standing Rock. This segment was produced by Glenn S. from CIVL Radio in Abbotsford, and audio files from Co-op Radio Vancouver and CKUW in Winnipeg.
Here's Gunari and Billy Pierre from Co-op Radio in Vancouver talking to Myron Dewey, who's been taking videos at Standing Rock.
Well, you know, just trying to cover through Indigenous eyes the media and following the protocols as well, when and when not to film, you know, and shutting up the camera and getting the approval. And so I'm also doing a youth media class down here with our youth storytellers and journalists.
Oh, my goodness. So this,
the
stand that people have been taking in North Dakota has actually influenced youth to pick up the camera and become the media?
Well, I'm coming in from Paiute Shoshone country, and I had some of our relatives down there in Paiute country buy iPads. And I got my camera, and whatever I got, I can share with them. And so we used mobile phones the first day, and now we're just trying to recruit some more youth to go in and do some digital story challenge from the inside out.
That's so great. Wow. There must be people from, like, all nations over there, eh?
You know, this is one of the strongest healing circles I've ever been to. You know, you have black, white, Chicano, all nations, and people coming in and in solidarity, and for non-natives to come in and in solidarity, that's part of the healing process.
Wow, that's so amazing. So everyone's united in the struggle for life to protect, I do believe, the Missouri River?
Yes, we can see it right here. Where I'm up on a hill we call Facebook Hill. It's the only spot where we can get internet and make calls. And you can see the water from here. Teepees are all lined up along it. People are camping and cooking, and right now, there's getting ready to be a show with some Native artists coming on, and it's awesome.
Gunari would also hear from Jesus, a Saskatoon-based musician who also took part in the events of Standing Rock.
And I see that there's a lot of action going on. To me, it seems like there's a lot of police presence. And can you tell me more about that from your perspective?
From what I hear, when we came in yesterday, it was a bit tense because a couple of brothers were actually arrested yesterday. At an incident at one of the sites. So basically the camp is not on site. So for a lot of people online who are sharing like information, just know that the camp has nothing to do with the actual pipeline construction site. The camp is where everybody's just kind of gathering and praying and basically taking care of each other and coming up with ways to get through this. You know, there's all types of things that need to be done, you know, just from the kitchen to the firewood to protecting the women in the sweats. There's also sweats going on out here from different tribes. There's marches. We went down by the burial grounds today, and it's crazy. But the feeling out here is unreal.
Uh-huh. Exactly. That's what I noticed. I've been watching a lot of how the Native youth there have pulled together to share this news. They've been getting funding for equipment like cameras, microphones, you name it, and now a trailer of all things, right? It's just amazing how it's motivated the people and inspired them to take this a step further.
No doubt. Today I've met people from all over North America, you know, all over North America, from Montreal, French-speaking natives to Paiute natives to Haida. Some of the Haida sisters just left this morning back to Haida Gwaii. So, I mean, you know, it's really crazy to come into a place that is completely foreign, like, to me, like, as far as, like, the location and the community and the people.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I don't know the place, like, and I've never been here before, but it feels like home.
That was Myron Dewey and Jesus, both from Standing Rock, talking to Gunari from Co-op Radio in Vancouver. CKUW Radio in Winnipeg would also examine the events unfolding in North Dakota.
And we're lucky enough to be joined in the studio by Sadie Phoenix-Lavoie. Tell us about your trip that you took last week down to the Dakotas. What was it like going there?
The Standing Rock Sioux Nations
Cannonball Reservation, where the river sustains so many communities. It wasn't the main drinking source, but there was going to be a pipeline that was going to be constructed to go right through it. So obviously posed a huge risk, high risk. And so the community, you know, banded together and was like, no, we have to resist this. And there was the Indigenous Environmental Network that went on, had a video, and they were saying that, you know, this is a very peaceful protest. It's done in ceremony where there's women and children and elders and, you know, pipe carriers and Eagle Staff carriers and all these drummers, singers, and they're all here, you know, defending the land. And we were calling on people for solidarity and support. They were saying that the Nakota, Dakota and Lakota, like the three nations, or there's like the second or seven fire councils. So like the seven nations representing that area. They said it was the first time that they ever banded together in alliance in over 100 years.
Lavoie wasn't the only person CKUW talked to about the Sacred Stone Camp. Here's Josini, also known as Healing Earth Woman, discussing the Standing Rock Sioux's resistance of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Okay. So you were in Standing Rock. You were at the Standing Rock Camp in recent weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that visit? I mean, how you came to be down there and a little bit about what you saw and experienced there.
It's a good thing, but it's also a sad thing because it's this big black snake that are bringing all the people together to fight against it. But it's also, like, it's amazing how many of our people are and all different tribes that are there.
The resistance that you talk about from the state and state authorities, I mean, could you talk a bit more, maybe the tactics they're using, underhanded or otherwise?
Well, the first thing that really, when I was down there, I was uncomfortable was when they started to talk about the National Guard coming in, and it's another form of psychological to put on the people so that, you know, like the actions were already starting to happen, and you know they already had these dogs that attacked the people, and you know it just that psychological warfare that the industry is putting on the people, and there are people who are going to stand up against it no matter what.
Yeah.
They're not going to back down.
That's it for the 2016 Year in Review episode of Groundwire.
Music this week was by A Tribe Called Red.
Thanks to all contributors from across the country for a great 2016 season. We also thank Glenn S., Carly Forbes, and Ome Salma Rahamtala for this review episode.
Tune in to hear Groundwire in 2017 on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.